It's time for Twig this week in Google. Ant's here. Jeff's here. Stacy has the week off. But good news, Kathy Gellis, attorney at law, is joining us just off the Supreme Court. She was there this morning to hear arguments in a very important copyright case. She'll give us an update. We'll also talk about the new Pixel 7 and the Pixel Watch, why you may or may not want it, and the Meta Quest Pro. It sounds like a pharmaceutical, but it's actually the latest in VR from Meta. But who wants it? We'll find out next on Twig.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twig.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 685, recorded Wednesday, October 12th, 2022. Only on Thursdays. This Week in Google is brought to you by SecureWorks. Are you ready for inevitable cyber threats? SecureWorks detects evolving adversaries and defends against them with a combination of security analytics and threat intelligence directly from their own counter-threat unit. Visit SecureWorks.com/twit to get a free trial of Taegis Extended Detection and Response, also known as XDR. And by CashFly. Deliver your video on the network with the best throughput and global reach, making your content infinitely scalable. Go live in hours, not days. Learn more at CashFly.com. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about pretty much everything but Google. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Ant Pruitt. We got a card for you, Ant.
Woo! Ant, I got a card. Lemonade.
Ant. Welcome from TV's Hands-On Photography.
How you be, sir?
I'm doing great. Community manager in our club Twit. We also have Jeff Jarvis, the Leonard Tow Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. His card's got a little more written on it. And this is very good news. I have a card for our special guest. Stacy broke her toe last night. So Catherine R. Gellis Esquire is here from cgcounsel.com. Former internet professional webmaster, now assisting clients with legal issues related to the digital age. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
You're in D.C.
I'm in D.C.
And why are you in D.C.?
You know, I guess if you're a lawyer, it's good to go where it gets made sometimes. So, you know, see it up close.
You went to the sausage factory in person.
I went to the sausage factory, yes.
And I understand that today you were in the Supreme Court.
Yes, there was an important copyright hearing at the U.S. Supreme Court. And I wrote an amicus brief in the case. And it's interesting to kind of see it live as they talk about really important issues and what they're going to do about it that are going to affect all our lives.
I bet you Kathy knows how to pronounce certiorari.
Certiorari,
I think. Certiorari, okay.
I knew. Amicus or amicus? I think I've been saying amicus. It's amicus.
Amicus?
I think it could be either. Some people seem to say it's the way that I don't pronounce it, and they're just wrong. So I think you can have whatever your own natural accent provides.
Last time, Kathy.
Does doing a brief get you a ticket into the Supreme Court?
No, it did not. I had to stand online. I got there at 6 a.m. and they only took 19 of the Supreme Court barred people, but I got in. But my friends who got there at 8 a.m. didn't. In previous years, I'd actually camped out for a case. I camped out for Aereo because there were line sitters and it was so competitive that we were afraid that we wouldn't get in. But then after that case, Justice Scalia said, enough of this nonsense. You're licensed by this court. Stop hiring line standards, so you had to do your own standing, and lawyers are lazy. Alito, so we just
so
show
you're barred
up
for the Supreme Court. Have you argued?
I am, which
court?
Is I could in theory. It's also how I'm able to file amicus briefs there. If I weren't barred in that court, I couldn't be the attorney that did that.
So the Onion is barred at the Supreme Court.
So they had to hire someone.
No, the Onion had counsel that was barred in the Supreme Court to file it. They may be barred by the Supreme Court at some point, given, you know, after that brief. But
we should probably explain.
Not barred in.
Barred in means you. It's like passing the bar. Is there a test? How do you get barred into the Supreme Court?
No, for So you get licensed by state, and they're the ones who, in theory, are testing, are doing the full test of moral character, and in theory, you know, your competence to be a lawyer. That's what people take the bar exam for. Open question about whether it's actually an effective test of competence, but that's what they do. But then different courts in the federal system do their own admissions if you want to practice before them. I think the individual district courts, and for them, you sometimes just need to pay a fee. Ah. Sometimes you pay a fee and add a little bit on a form. Sometimes you need references. And then for the U.S. Supreme Court, it's basically the same thing. It was mostly a form, but you had to have been in practice, I think, 3 years, although maybe five. And you had to get people that signed your form kind of as move-ins. So like they moved to have you admitted in the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's a little more formal, but basically all you have to do is be a lawyer, not get in trouble, and fill out a form. But if you do get in trouble after, you can get kicked out. My understanding is that Bill Clinton, after he was impeached, got kicked out of the Supreme Court bar because they didn't like that nonsense. He wasn't a good moral character, et cetera.
Do you get a bumper sticker or anything? You get a little something to put on your desk?
They sent a certificate. A lot of the courts sent a certificate. My certificate, I think if I remember, is sort of large because it's the U.S. Supreme Court. But the interesting thing was there were two people I had to get signed. One I think was a reference, but the other was called the move-in. And I got my con law professor from law school, the really scary kind of paper chase con law professor. He signed mine. And for some reason, that name, then when I got my certificate, his name is like, and the person who moved you is. And so my con law professor is on my Supreme Court certificate for having moved me into the Supreme Court. That was kind of cool. I actually thought that was like an accident. That was a nice accident that that happened. So, yeah, mostly paperwork. But, you know, sometimes lawyering is all about the paperwork. So, you know, you do paperwork.
You chose it.
Well, not for the paperwork, but yes.
So why you're there for the Andy Warhol case? Tell us why you're there.
So there were a couple of cases, losing track of time now. Time, how does it work? A couple of years ago, a case in the Second Circuit coming out of New York, and a case also that was similarly troubling that ended up coming out of the Ninth Circuit. What these cases essentially did was decide that subsequent works didn't count as fair uses. And if they didn't count as fair uses, then they would be infringing copyright. So both cases ended up, they both won at the district court, where both of these subsequent uses that used another work were found to be fair uses of the work. In the Ninth Circuit, this was the case involving the Dr. Seuss mashup with the Oh, the Places Will Boldly Go, where somebody wrote a book that took Star Trek imagery and combined it with Dr. Seuss motifs.
Bad taste, but not illegal.
Actually, it was really well done. Actually, I think it was quite clever. Like, you know, it kind of really united those things in actually a really meaningful way that added new meaning. And that's important. We'll get back to new meaning. Meanwhile, there was also a case in New York, and this was less recent, but there had been a photograph of Andy Warhol taken in like the early 80s that then ended up that Andy Warhol then ended up adapting and turning into the really famous Prince, P-R-I-N-T-S, of Prince, P-R-I-N-C-E. This is a very
It was a picture of Prince, not Andy Warhol. It was this picture from the 80s. Lynn Goldsmith took the picture, and this is Andy Warhol's portrait. Even before then, wasn't there a AP sued Shepard Fairey over this famous Obama Hope poster because an AP photographer took the picture? That one was settled out of court.
Yeah, that one hit a weird roadblock in discovery and never really got decided on the merits. Everyone kind of bailed out of that case. So it wasn't really figured out. But there was an important case in, I guess, the late 80s called Campbell versus Acuff Rose. And this was a really important fair use case that the Supreme Court considered. This is the one where, and now I'm blanking on the name, it was it Beast? No. There was a takeoff of Pretty Woman. That was a very raunchy takeoff parody.
It was Two Life Crew, yeah.
Two Live Crew. Yeah. And that was a really important case because Roy Orbison or his estate really didn't like that. It was, you know, it's a kind of crude song, and they didn't like they called it infringement, and they didn't like that it was messing with their song. And the Supreme Court said, no, you know, we really need to create space to have new meanings and new things come out. This has to be a fair use. But, you know, that case can really only reach the merits for what the facts of that case were challenging it for. But it had it had language for how to think about a situation like that. And then it had some other helpful dicta that sort of helped guide courts in the future to find that other subsequent uses, even when it used identifiable source works, could still be considered fair use.
One of the tests
in theory, that's what it was.
In the Two Live Crew case was, did it have cause commercial harm to Roy Orbison? Would it cause loss of sales to Pretty Woman? And the Supreme Court said it's extremely unlikely.
I mean, that is true. So fair use built into the statute has a multi-factor test. It's not necessarily exhaustive, but there are four factors that used to be thought of at common law, but then they kind of baked them in the statute when they updated the copyright statute for the 1976 Act. And I should pull them up. I have
them in front of me.
Okay, so there's four factors that you look at, and you kind of analyze, okay, so you have the original work, and then you have the subsequent work. And let's say especially that the subsequent work is, you know, somehow hearkening back an identifiable way to the original. That may still be fair use, but you're going to decide if it's fair use by thinking through those factors. So that's great, but it's also really, really, really fuzzy.
Fair use... Is as somebody once said, merely the right to hire a lawyer.
That Lawrence Lessig said.
Yeah,
that.
Larry Lessig. So the four cases are the purpose of the use, whether it's for commercial, for instance, or a nonprofit or educational. That's number one. Number two, the nature of the copyrighted work. Number three, the amount and substantiality of the portion used. And number four, the effect of the use upon the potential market or value of the copyrighted work. It was that fourth test the Supreme Court said, yeah, you didn't cost Roy Orbison anything. I'd heard also that the parody defense. So, for instance, when Weird Al makes a parody song, it has to parody the original maker of the song. It can't be devoid of that. It has to refer back to the original.
That's what we know more for certain.
Yeah.
Because some of it has to do with commentary, like fair use
commentary.
Is a theory of indication of First Amendment rights to have free expression. And copyright in theory impinges on that. But one of the ways that copyright is not in compliant with the First Amendment is to make sure that you still have free expression around it. And fair use helps preserve the ability to freely express other things. It's there to help vindicate that other expression can happen. So if you're commenting on the original, then that tends to be more clearly, and there's precedent, I think, on point about this to say, well, okay, you know, we can't make that illegal because then we'd have a First Amendment problem. But that doesn't necessarily mean that other types of expression couldn't be legal too, but sometimes it's not tested. Or then you get these cases that I'm describing where all of a sudden, like, the district court looked at them and looked at these subsequent uses and said, yes, they're fair use. But on appeal, the appeals court said, nah, we don't think so. They basically reran the four-factor test and reran it in a way that looked at the subsequent use and said, nope. We don't see clear to do this. This must be infringing. And so this case at the U.S. Supreme Court was, hang on, it doesn't look like the way. And I bring up the Ninth Circuit case because it was similar and I think really troubling, and in a way that I think highlights what was troubling about this one somewhat more clearly. But in this particular case where the Second Circuit said, nope, Andy Warhol must have infringed essentially when his prints were not fair use. All of a sudden, there's a question about, is that decision right? But also, what would it mean for any subsequent uses? Because the logic they used in running those four-factor tests would shut down an awful lot of other expression that happens to build on other works. And you really need to be able to build on other works to be able to say new things. So that would create a really chilling effect. So what was before the court today was, hang on a second, did the Second Circuit get it right? And they were talking most particularly about the fourth factor, but also the first factor with the purpose and character of the work, and questions about whether the new work brought new meaning. And if yes, what is the significance that it did bring new meaning, and how should that
affect? Why did this come so many years
after? Let me give you the facts of the case so you understand that.
Thank you.
The picture was taken in 1981 by a photographer Goldsmith before he was famous. 3 years later, Vanity Fair commissioned Andy Warhol for a series of 6 silkscreen prints, as well as 2 pencil sketches based on the original photograph, and published them. However, the Vanity Fair had obtained a license from Goldsmith, but she said she was not aware that Warhol created other images that were not licensed. In fact, she only became aware after Condé Nast used a different image, one she had not licensed, as part of a 2016 Prince tribute immediately after his death. Of course, Warhol died in 87. The relevant works are held by the Andy Warhol Foundation, which had given permission to Vanity Fair to use the image in 2016, but Goldsmith was not created. So that's when she sued. In 2019, a federal judge ruled in favor of the Andy Warhol Foundation, saying the images were transformative, because while Goldsmith's photo showed a vulnerable human being, the Warhol prints depicted an iconic, larger-than-life figure. Actually, that sounds like they were ruling against the foundation. I think that NBC got this one wrong. ruled against the foundation. The foundation then sought Supreme Court review after the second court ruled in favor of the photographer in March 2021.
The foundation holds the Warhol version. And they were saying the Warhol version was, in fact, a larger-than-life image. So they were in favor of the foundation against Goldsmith.
Yes, you're right. Second Circuit said, the photographer wins. The appeals court faulted the district court for focusing on the artist's intent, saying that the judge should not assume the role of art critic.
That's the interesting part,
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Instead, a judge must examine whether the new work is of a completely different character to the original. It must, quote, at a bare minimum, comprise something more than the imposition of another artist's style on the primary work.
But that's part of the comment.
That takes us to the Supreme Court. Kathy, what did your amicus brief say?
Our amicus brief, I did this for the Copy Institute, which is the think tank half of TechDirt, is we base 2 big points. One was to remind the court that copyright law has to comport with the First Amendment. So the first half of the thing was talking about, if copyright law is all of a sudden saying no to free expression or somehow not helping further the progress of arts and sciences, which the Constitution says is what copyright is for, then you've got a problem. And so if you're looking at a case where all of a sudden you're saying no to further expression, that suggests that if that's the way copyright law is being interpreted, you have a problem. And then we talked further about the reason I talk about the Dr. Seuss case is I was so alarmed by that case in the Ninth Circuit, basically saying, how dare you create something new that the original copyright holder for all Dr. Seuss works didn't license you to do, and just how foreclosing that would be if the original copyright holder mm-hmm. could say no to things. And we also pointed out that, it's different in this case, in this Warhol case, where Warhol, the subsequent user, is dead and the photographer is still alive. But in the Dr. Seuss case, it was the other way around. The estate of a dead person was saying no to the new creative work of a live person. And if that's something that copyright law says is okay, I think we have to think twice about it, especially given the really long terms that copyright has. That's a problem, I think, if that can happen. And so we pointed out how that fact alone helps illustrate what happens when you chill the ability of other people to rebuild things and create something that might never have existed if the original creator, I mean, a dead person is never going to do it, but maybe they wouldn't have licensed things anyway. The Ninth Circuit sort of took the view of like, well, as a copyright holder, they could have decided to license to a Star Trek mashup or a, I don't know, a Mickey Mouse mashup or any sort of other mashup that they wanted that they chose to license. But either nobody knocked on their door or they weren't interested in doing the deal. So none of those mashups happened, especially not one with this particular expression and charm, until this artist independently thought, I can make a fair use by combining these two things and creating something new. The district court said that looks good under the four-factor fair use test and relying on the Campbell versus Acuff Rose test. And then the Ninth Circuit just sort of said, nope, nope, you're too greatly cutting into the exclusive rights of the copyright holder. And that's something that came up today because copyright also, one of the exclusive rights that a copyright holder has is to control derivative works. And there's a tension in the Copyright Act between a derivative work and the fair uses of works, which may be transformative in their right. meanings. And so what is the difference between a transformative work and a derivative work? Because one would be legal as a fair use and the other one would not. And, you know, this is actually when I was learning copyright law was really confusing and made me very frustrated. Like, how do I learn this? Like, how do I get my head around that tension? And that tension is sitting in the statute. But what the Warhol side was arguing a little bit is that the text does sort of say that, like, the derivative work right is subject to fair use, the fair use rules as well. And then they kind of point out what would it mean to subsequent free expression if, because everybody somehow references a source work somehow, what would happen?
Walt Disney didn't base Snow White on nothing. And of course, famously, Walt Disney then copyrighted it so no one else could make a Snow White. The Brothers Grimm, I guess, didn't get their day in court. So today was the day for oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court. That's why you were there, among other things. We learned that Clarence Thomas was a Prince fan. Who knew?
But not necessarily anymore. Only on Thursdays, apparently. So the thing unfolded where he started with a hypothetical of, let's say I were a Prince fan. And then he says under his breath, like, which I was back in the 80s. And then I think Justice Kagan kind of piped up, and no longer. And everybody in the room laughed. And then he kind of pulled himself together and said, well, only on Thursdays.
It's interesting because you don't usually think of the Supreme Court as having any banter during these oral arguments, but they do actually.
You know, one of my takeaways I was telling somebody is I'm actually really glad I went as somebody who practices before the court because I've been really, really angry with them and for good reason. Their jurisprudence has been frightening. The way they've been comporting mm-hmm. themselves has been disturbing. They've really sort of taken themselves down a notch in esteem and what they're worthy. And also, but what happens to our system of law if it's not? Like, you know, we talked at the beginning of the show about what it was like, you know, getting admitted to the Supreme Court bar. The first thing they do before every oral argument is there's some people who actually get admitted on the spot. Like their papers are all in, but then the court verbally grants that their motions be granted, and then they're given the oath on the spot, and there's like all this dignity built into it. So when they're kind of cutting corners and changing the rules and this, then the other thing, it's really heartbreaking, almost on a religious level of like, no, this is something we really kind of revere and need to revere. So my attitude has been very, very cynical, growingly cynical. I kind of appreciated being in the room and being reminded of the human beings. I mean, I don't think it redeems the systemic things that are so troubling, but I think it made me not hate them quite so much. And I think I needed to be reminded that these are people and that my skills and my writing could still potentially speak to these people. They have ways of thinking about things. And my job as a practitioner is figuring out how to convey something that they can hear.
They're not gods. Although they have godlike power in some cases.
Yeah. But I was actually surprised by the report. They seem to be
collegial. They seem to get along.
They did.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Kathy, I saw a tweet today, and I couldn't get the context of it, so I just saw somebody come, oh my God, the government's arguing against fair use.
That's not true at all.
It's not true at all.
It's a debate about what is fair use, right?
I was, well, splitting the baby a little bit. I think Jeff is actually more correct.
Really?
They basically took the photographer side. And their model for how they did it, I think, was troubling. It's been too long since I've seen it, but Mark Lemley kind of summed it up in two lines of like, if this is what they were arguing, some fundamental thing is missing. But overall, and I can't remember what that was, even though it was pithy and correct, but I think the model that they want is really one that closes the door on an awful lot of fair uses. And they were explicitly taking the side of the photographer and not on the side of the derivative work. And I think some of the biggest argument was, well, because one of the problems is that this is involving photography, and photography has such a limited runway in terms of how it can be monetized, and it's so easy to copy. And photographers were writing like really panicked amicus briefs saying like, if you grant this as fair use, photography is dead. And I think that might be overstating it. And I think there's still monetization models and this, then the other thing, but it is a very difficult medium to protect, especially if you have expansive fair use. So that's true. And I think the government's position was, but we've got some licensing models that provide monetization that creates income. And if you have too much fair use, then those licensing models will fall apart and the economics of photography will change. And I can see the alarm in the government wanting to sort of, you know, protect photographers, but I think they're trying to protect the photographers at the expense of photographers themselves, because it's at the expense of anybody who would like to make subsequent expression. And sometimes that's photographers. Everybody mm-hmm. needs fair use mm-hmm. to be able to sort of speak, because we always reference in some way something that came before. And the longer a copyright term, the more expansive a copyright seems to be, the more exclusive rights and the more powerful those rights, the harder it is for anybody to speak. And I think that's dangerous. I think they are taking the wrong view and needed to take a more global view of, we got to keep people talking, and if we want to keep people creating.
Here's a dumb question.
A couple of ish points to make is, one is that oral arguments aren't always the best way to understand the justice's point of view on this, right?
True. It's very difficult to read the tea leaves off of an oral argument.
Second point, you can listen for yourself. The Supreme Court publishes the audio, not the video, but the audio from oral arguments. And this one's already up, of all things, an hour and 42.
This one was live. It's actually, I mean, the pandemic made a mess of so much, but one of the benefits of the pandemic mm-hmm. is that this court used to not have any live broadcasts or live of anything, of any of their hearings. And they started doing live simulcast, only sound, not video, but they started doing that during the pandemic. And they just really last week, this week, opened up to having the public in the court for oral arguments again, because it had still been closed for the pandemic. And there was a question of, well, when people can come back in, are they going to turn off the simulcast? And no, they kept it on. And this is to the court's credit. I think it's really important, and I hope they keep it going. And the fact that they did so far makes me hope that they will.
Yeah.
Or somebody forgot to turn it off.
Supreme Court.
No, I think they did it on purpose. They did acknowledge that they were doing it.
If you go to supremecourt.gov and click the oral arguments link at the top, you'll see all of the week's oral arguments so far. And you can listen to it, including today's. Okay, Jeff, sorry.
I need to wake up at 6 a.m. This is silly.
I just had a dumb question, Kathy. In a case like this, where it's one party against the other, why is the government a party, and is the government always a party?
It's not a party. I don't actually know what it's. It might be an intervener, but I don't know. Essentially happens is, I mean, sometimes I guess
it's
the government.
Andy Warhol Foundation versus Goldsmith. It's the foundation versus the photographer.
So why was the government making arguments today?
Sometimes the court actually asked the government to lodge a view. I don't remember if it was done on invitation this time, or there might have been a motion that the government wrote its brief and then say, we want to submit it. The other thing that
the government was Yaira Dubin, who was amicus curiae. So it was another amicus.
It was amicus, okay.
But they got to do oral argument, and that is, they had to do that on an ask, but I think it was unopposed. I think if the government shows up and says, we'd like to speak to it, it did it.
What did Dubin say? What was her position?
Well, the government took the same position that it took in the briefs, which is they were very worried about the fair use test if fair use could be found the way Warhol was arguing, they were afraid of the consequences. They did not want a test that was that broad.
So, that's interesting.
And so they were much more limited. They were somewhat differing from what the photographer was saying in terms of what the test should be. But basically, they
Hollywood thought
more
lobby.
Of a narrow test than a broader test.
This is more of they took the Hollywood side versus the Silicon Valley side.
I'm reading Lawrence Hurley's article for NBC. He said that the justices seem to focus on purpose of the images, Warhol's image versus Goldsmith's image, and that the fact that they were both used in the same way to illustrate articles about the singer seemed to be an issue. That Judge Sotomayor said, does the fact that the images have the same market, is that enough to destroy your defense? Justice Gorsuch said the Prince images were quite different from Warhol's images of Campbell's soup cans because the difference in purpose in the latter instance was obvious. He wasn't trying to sell Campbell's soup.
So Gorsuch said that, okay, the Campbell's, because they're using Warhol imagery as an example. So Warhol has the famous Campbell's soup can sitting in a picture by itself. And Gorsuch basically said, well, that's an easier case to find the fair use because the original label is designed to sell soup, and this purpose is designed to, antagonize the consumer state or something like that. Like, you're not using them.
Show one,
they don't have the same function, essentially. But they're looking at essentially two pictures of Prince, and they're like, they have the same function in that they are to convey a picture of Prince, and in this case, more specifically, in a magazine.
Although Chief Justice Roberts said, no, it's a different style. It's a different purpose. One is a commentary on modern society. The other is to show what Prince looks like. So he argued, again, you can't
tell,
read too much into the tea leaves here.
Hair-splitting.
Well, but that's what the Supreme Court does.
Wow.
That's their job.
So Roberts was sort of getting back to what the district court found. The district court made the point, which I think is valid, which is if you look at those two pictures and you had that up on the screen, and I think it illustrates it, the original picture that Goldsmith took portrays Prince as kind of as a different sort of person with a different sort of persona than the adapted one that Warhol did. So what Warhol Foundation's argument is they're not conveying the same thing. The way Warhol treated that image in creating his transformative work transformed it in a way where it said something else about Prince that the original one hadn't said. And then the question they were saying that, well, the test is that the purpose is that they are saying something different about Prince. Like, yes, they're both pictures. Yes, they're both pictures that may be used in a magazine to illustrate an article about Prince, but they are saying different things. And I think one argument that got left on the table, although the Warhol side sort of intimated at it, is that, they're not, yes, they're competing with each other, but they're not competing with each other as literal copies of each other. They're competing with each other, like, not for price and sale term or licensing terms or this, then the other thing. They're essentially competing each other for, if you're doing an article about Prince, which is the image that you think conveys the thing about Prince that you wish to have convey is to complement your article. Like,
well,
there's
now you'll
something
just have AI
so
make
different
one.
In that message. I'm
now
sorry?
You'll just have AI make one. Now you'll just have AI, DALL-E make one, and it won't make any difference. Which is a question, actually, Kathy. Yeah. Was there any discussion in the court today of the remaking mode of online and how art is changing now in a collaborative way of constant remix?
I think not, and probably thank goodness. If it came up, it did not linger very long. It does not ring a bell, and boy, that gives me a headache. But because if we're having enough problems with like what humans can do, we're not at the point of.
Well, I'm not talking about the AI. I'm not talking about the AI. I'm talking about any old schmo using Instagram to remake something to make a statement. The remixing of culture today is on such a different scale. And if they try to cut off that from anybody, it's one matter to, use a photo you don't have permission for. It's another matter to make a comment on it by your use of it in just the fact that anyone can do that now. And it's not just Vanity Fair. It's a much broader market.
Oh, the Warhol Foundation made a point, which is that one of the things that the photographer, and I think even the government may have argued, is that everybody, oh, and I think even the Second Circuit, was that they sort of got stars in their eyes where, oh, it's a Warhol thing, so it must be different and special because it's Warhol, mm-hmm. where he's famous, mm-hmm. and we're looking back on it, and that, because it was a Warhol thing, we're going to look at it differently, and of course we're going to assume that there's a different meaning, and so they're sort of bootstrapping on the fame to decide that there's different meaning, and the Warhol Foundation sort of pointed out of like, no, it's not about us. This is really about the unknown artist who wants to create work that remixes and reuses something that came before and
Amen.
Isn't going to have the fame to be able to, like, all of a sudden, like, oh, because you don't know his name. So if you hear Joe Schmo's new art, you're not going to presume, oh, it's something new and different. You're just going to know it's a subsequent work, and that you're not going to have that reputation to enhance the concept of meaning.
Yes.
And he's like,
I'm
so it can't be that. Dependent on this reputation, because what our job is to protect those new artists who someday may be the Warhols, but they're never going to be the Warhols because they're going to be too scared to ever make any work because it won't be enough that it has enough a different meaning, because it'll still be identified as the original one. And then both the Goldsmith and even the government were making this point, which is that, well, fair use is an affirmative defense, which is getting back to that lesson quote that fair use is the right to hire a lawyer. That's not useful if you're a creator. If you have to hire a lawyer or to defend yourself and hope that a court sees it your way, you're not going to produce
we
the
deal
art
with
at
that all the time.
Nope.
There's a chilling effect, and we're always here, always aware of that chilling effect, because I don't want to have to defend it in court, even though I firmly believe most of what we do is fair use, because we're news and we're covering news. And let me ask you, as a photographer, because I think, you know, you have a dog in this hunt as a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at, this is from the SCOTUS blog images. So this is, on the right is the actual Lynn Goldsmith 1981 photograph of Prince. On the left is the Vanity Fair cover in which they're using that photograph, essentially, mm-hmm. modified by Andy Warhol. They did pay Lynn Goldsmith, I think, $400 for the right to do that. It was only the other images that she saw later that caused her to sue. What's your reaction to this? Does this, are you naturally on the side of the photographer?
Yeah, in this instance, I'm standing with the photographer.
She took this picture.
Rates.
Yeah.
Right. We set rates from client to client. You know, there are portrait photographers out there that will charge X amount of dollars to certain individuals. But if that individual is CEO of Google, is probably going to charge that person a little bit more because of reach and other places that image can be shown. And we want to make sure we capitalize properly off of that.
How do you feel now if I show you the other images, which are much more clearly artworks that weren't licensed, and this is what she's suing over? Does that change it?
Nope. That's still my shot. That's a derivative of my capture. You didn't capture this.
Yeah.
And that's how I look at it.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the AI earlier. I thought the AI had some type of fences in place that...
No, it doesn't.
...tried to stop from putting... Like, I can put prints in, but it's not going to give me an actual picture of prints.
Oh, maybe, but the AI does...
The style of... Warhol, example.
Yeah, you could say I want a drawing of Prince in the style of Warhol.
It's more about Warhol. The AI is more about Warhol and taking the style than necessarily an image, because the AI can do 100 images of Prince.
Dolly, too, is much more careful about images of people.
And makes
a
mess.
But Stable Diffusion is not at all. And you can very much, with Stable Diffusion, get Prince pictures. You could probably get this picture. Because
the larger question here.
It trains on all these images, and it could train on this image from SCOTUS blog, really. You know, it could.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Training on something to have as a background is one thing, but reproducing the exact same image, I think that's problematic.
How close is close? You know, part of the issue here,
this is what Kathy was talking about. What about derivatives? So... Walt Disney didn't make up Sleeping Beauty. He derived it from the Brothers Grimm.
Yeah.
Much of art is based on previous works of art. And that's how an artist proceeds. You've learned photography by looking a lot of people's photographs, and it could, in fact, be that some of your
trying
images...
Trying to imitate other photographers.
Exactly. Look like
exactly
those.
Exactly how that works. Those,
that's how it works. So
and others you.
Society sees this, and this is why... there's limits on copyright. Society sees this as a societal good, that things are copyright for a limited period of time, but then enter into the public domain where others can, you know, elaborate on them and become part of the kind of, in fact, this is what Larry Lessig was so interested in when he created Creative Commons. He said, public domain, saying I'm going to put this in public domain is insufficient. Copyright is too much. There needs to be something in between that allows me as a creator to assert certain rights, but to still allow people to create derivative rights. Kathy, am I saying that? Do you feel like, is that accurate?
Creative Commons.
Oh, she disappeared.
Creative Commons tweeted, and I dig this tweet, and says, even with the Creative Commons license, fair use is key to free expression. Everything builds on other works, and copyright depends on, just as you were saying, everything builds on other works, and copyright depends on limitations and expectations. So they're hoping that the courts recognize this in the cases today.
Let me see if I can get a portrait of Prince in the style of Andy Warhol.
I just put in, which one is this?
This is Lexica. This is
Midjourney.
Yeah, you have Midjourney. This is Lexica. And these are all AI generated. That's Prince,
ooh,
obviously.
Ooh. Right?
There's Michael Jackson somehow snuck in. So, I mean, that, you know, by the
some
way,
of those look really close to being Prince.
One thing that we didn't mention is, where are Prince's rights in all of this? None of this is
all gone.
They're gone. He has no rights. He let the photographer take the picture.
Well, he wouldn't have had a copyright in his face. And this is actually also sort of an important point. There's other things that are running through copyright law, like merger and the fact that you can't copyright facts. So the basics of what he looked like, in theory, the question is,
he
how
doesn't
much
own his likeness.
Not as a copy.
Only if it's used for commercial purposes that he doesn't approve of.
Well, that's a completely separate thing. That might be right of publicity type things. There's some really weird things that are happening now that we're starting to take inventory of how much we own about everything.
Because of deep fakes. Yeah.
Well, not just that. I'm not necessarily a fan of this. The idea of like divvying up the whole world and that we own the whole world is... this is not a model that will scale to accommodate everything we needed to accommodate. But no, he wouldn't have a copyright in his face. Now, there is an open question sometimes with photography of the issue is who brought the originality to it. It's kind of generally presumed as the photographer. But if the subjects in the picture basically position themselves, stage themselves, direct the lighting, like at some point, the resulting photograph may not really be the original photographer's. It might actually start to be the people in the photo. That's not generally presumed to be the case, but that is a thing that in theory could happen and copyright would enable. But the other point I was getting to is, you know, there's a very factual basis and copyright law is supposed to resist somebody locking up the only way to speak something or the facts of something, that stuff is not supposed to be subject to copyright. And with photography, where you've got something that's so realism based, because essentially what they're arguing got copied here was not the artistry that went into the original photograph, but maybe just the essence of what his face looked like at that pose. And they didn't really discuss that, but I wonder if they should have, because they're really sort of saying that Goldsmith, so much of what you see was Goldsmith's originality, and that's maybe an assumption that needs to be tested. But in theory, that got tested at the lower courts. And here they were just sort of kicking around what is the appropriate test that should have been used to look at those four factors. And did the Second Circuit get that right?
We've spent half an hour talking about this. Why should we care?
Would you like to continue to have free expression?
We should care. Let's think about... you and Mrs. Laporte, y'all go out and take photographs quite often.
Yes.
Just for fun.
Yes.
And let's say that you had the opportunity to recreate that Marilyn Monroe scene of her making that pose and the thing blowing, and you snap it, and it turns out to be an amazing photograph that you captured of Mrs. Laporte in that pose. All of a sudden, you got somebody knocking on your door. Do you want that?
I think I'd win that case, but I don't want to have to spend the money to defend it.
Yeah, right. But I think Ant is making my argument. Like, you've now in some way made a derivative work. Now, you've made it in a different way than Warhol made this. There is the question that because he had access, and it's complicated by he had licensed access to this specific original, what does that mean for the purposes of the test? But then the Warhol Foundation pointed out, like, well, okay, so you're mad that he used this particular image, How would it be better if he had just infringed on somebody else's image? Like, that can't possibly be the solution. He needed something to make his transformative work.
If I put a purple frock on Mona Lisa.
They had a Mona Lisa hypo during the hearing. They did, actually.
Give us the hypo.
Justice Roberts put it. I'm trying to remember. I remember Justice Roberts. I can't remember what he said. I think it had to do with if you've taken the Mona. Oh, I think it was Alito. Sorry. It was Alito. Yeah. If you take the Mona Lisa and you make a very. He's like, pretend that the Mona Lisa is still in copyright. If you take the Mona Lisa and you adapt it in some small way where the general public.
Oh, she's frozen. We may never know.
So, Leo,
I actually have it in Lawrence.
Oh, you have it? Okay.
Hurley's article. He is how I knew it. Justice Samuel Alito questioned: how much court should defer to expert witnesses when deciding whether a work shows a different meaning? While an average person might view a copy of Da Vinci's Mona Lisa in which the subject wears a different colored dress. An expert in Renaissance art would see it as transformative. You say, well, that, you know, there's no issue. It's not the Mona Lisa. Alito told one of the attorneys, you make it sound simple, but maybe it's not so simple, at least in some cases, to determine what is the meaning or message of a work of art. I think actually these oral arguments are quite, I'm going to listen to them when I get home because I think quite interesting.
Another answer to your question is it's about protecting the public domain. And what we can do with that.
The commons, the creative commons are preserved because that's where art comes from. No one creates in a vacuum. We got Kathy.
I put up something on 984.
I'll let Kathy. No, no, stop.
Oh, sorry.
We'll let Kathy finish her thought.
Oh, sorry. The internet. So the Mona Lisa hypo was if it had to do with who's defining new meaning. So the hypo was that you've changed the Mona Lisa ever so slightly, where most people don't notice that you have something new and different, but to a Renaissance expert, that difference is really striking and significant. And they were questioning, and the hypo was, is that enough new meaning to affect the analysis? Because one of the big sources of tension is how much does new meaning matter?
What's transformative? Yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Is it enough just to put a line on it?
And is that relevant for the first factor test in particular? Like, is that new meaning? The argument that the Warhol Foundation is that the Second Circuit really excluded the fact that there was new meaning in the subsequent work, where they think that on that alone, it was error to go back down to be refought, to say, no, you have to at least consider it. But then there's still the question of consider it and then what? How dispositive should it be? And the government and the photographer were arguing not very dispositive given all the other factors. What is it doing to the market? And ultimately what they were arguing about was purpose of you still got two pictures that are about prints and that's not different enough because they're both still serving the purpose of being pictures of prints. But the argument on the other side is, but they are fulfilling a different purpose, saying different things about prints. And is that something that should really, you know, pass muster with the first factor? The other thing that they were also getting stuck on, although it's maybe tangential to this, is necessity. How much did you need that original? And they got lost in that argument a lot. And the government and the photographer seem to be arguing that necessity really needs to be more important of like, but you have to prove that you really needed this picture in order to make the new statement you were trying to make. But I think that's really chilling. And the Warhol argument, the Warhol Foundation was arguing that of course you need it. You would always need it. You'd always need something. And, you know, what do you mean that you'd have to prove that, you know, somehow prove in a defense that no, this is really the thing and not some other picture that I could have used, even though that other picture might be in copyright and then I'd just be infringing them and we'd be having that case. So, I think that's a bit of a red herring.
Was the photographer, Lynn Goldsmith, in the courtroom?
I was told yes, but I don't know what she looks like, so I can't quite confirm.
I mean, she obviously, she has an
interested party.
She's a very interested party. All right, we're going to end this, but that was
fascinating. Can I just mention one thing real quick, because I think your audience will find it interesting. A Communia Association, C-O-N-N-U-N-I-A, I put it line 84, has policy recommendations on copyright, 14 of them, which I think are very good, because I think we basically part of what we're doing here is we're reconsidering the nature of copyright as a whole. You know, when it started, it did not include news. It did not include magazines. It didn't include a lot of maps. It didn't include a lot of things. And how much it's been expanded, not only in time, but in scope. It's worthwhile in a new age to reconsider the essence of it.
This is for the EU particularly. Yeah. They have very different rules in the EU. But I like this paragraph, which says to defend and expand public domain, protect and promote usage rights, empower creators and their audiences. And I think that's part of this tension between creators who want to pull up the ladder once they've created and new creators who want to come along and say, we want to
never really the creators. What do I learn in
it's
researching
the owners,
copyright?
Isn't it? Yeah.
It was creating a tradable asset for the owners.
And that was always, in fact, that's Corey's point in his choke point capitalism, which is quite good, is that copyright is used as a weapon against creators by people like the music publishers and the motion picture industry, not the creators themselves.
I don't think Ed Sheeran is really a fan of copyright at this point. I mean, and quite frankly, it's terrifying to be a songwriter in the Ninth Circuit. Like, you're just, you know, you're just
Mike wrote a really good post. Was it Mike? I think wrote a good post today.
He actually won the Shape of You copyright case and was awarded $1.1 million in legal fees.
But he's not done. He just got attacked again.
Today there's another post about it.
Another one.
Yeah. And then like somebody
so that was in 2017.
Catalog, it's sort of like the catalog doesn't have the value he thought. I don't know. It's such a mess.
The second post.
Interesting.
By Mike.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a little break when we come back. Kathy, if you want to stick around, you're more than welcome to. We're going to be talking about things like the Pixel phone. If you want to get home, do you going to take the Xella home or?
I'm just in a friend's office, and as long as I can stay here and not get locked in, I'm happy to stay
here
for a while.
We'd love to have you. Thank you. Our show today brought to you.
It may not be overnight.
No, it won't be overnight. I promise you. In fact, I told Jeff before the show, we're going to try to get this thing down under 2 hours. Sunday, we did the longest tweet ever. I think it was 3 hours, 24 minutes. And so,
3 hours, 24 minutes, sir.
Trying really hard now to take an hour off of that.
Who was on?
I don't know. Went I was asleep Dow. Through half of it.
Went to it, Dow, Ian Thompson, and Ben Parr.
It was a great show, actually. But
wow.
And that's my problem is when the conversation starts getting good, I lose track of time, and that's not a good thing. So we're gonna try to keep this one on schedule. Our show today brought to you by SecureWorks. SecureWorks is a leader in cybersecurity, building solutions for security experts by security experts. SecureWorks offers superior threat detection and rapid incident response, all while making sure customers are never locked into a single vendor. This is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, the month of October, which means now would be a great time to raise awareness about digital security and empower everyone to protect their data from cybercrime. SecureWorks has the perfect solution. Now's the time to get their Taegis XDR, Extended Detection and Response. In 2022, this year, cybercrime, it's estimated, will cost the world $7 trillion. Trillion with a T. But it's not stopping. No, by 2025, that figure will grow to $10.5 trillion. Last year, ransomware, as far as we know, and I suspect these numbers are low, totaled $20 billion in damages. Attacks occurred every 11 seconds. By 2031, ransomware is expected to cost $265 billion a year and strike every 2 seconds. I bet it'll be worse than that even. Make sure your organization's not the next victim with SecureWorks Taegis XDR. SecureWorks Taegis provides superior detection, identifying more than 470 billion security events every day. Some of them aren't real, so it has to go through them, prioritize the true positive alerts, eliminate alert noise, allowing organizations to focus on the real threat, and it's out there. In addition, Taegis offers unmatched response. Automated response actions can actually eliminate threats before damage is ever done. With SecureWorks Taegis Managed XDR, you can easily leverage SecureWorks experts to investigate and respond to threats on your behalf. That helps you cut dwell times, decrease operational burden, reduce cost. And with Taegis XDR's 24/7 by 365 coverage, whether you experience a Christmas Day security event or half your team is out sick, you can trust SecureWorks is behind you. Many companies facing a shortage of security talent, SecureWorks acts as an extension of your security team on day one, alleviating cybersecurity talent gaps. It allows you to customize the approach and the coverage level that you need. Now, here's an important bit of information. I want you to write this down. What happens if you've already found an intruder in your system? Believe it or not, there's no need to worry. Just write down this number, 1-800-BREACHED. 1-800-BREACHED. That number, whether you're a customer or not, will connect you with the SecureWorks Emergency Incident Response Team. They can provide you with immediate assistance 24/7. They're there so they can respond to and remediate a possible cyber incident or data breach. You're not alone. At SecureWorks, you can learn more about the way today's threat environment is evolving, the risks it could present to your organization. They've got case studies there. They've got reports from their very prestigious counter threat unit and more. Visit SecureWorks.com/twit. Get a free trial of Taegis XDR. SecureWorks.com/twit. SecureWorks, defending every corner of cyberspace. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Google. That was good. It was not Google, but it wasn't fun. Elon Musk. So it could go, you know, I mean, it's...
Exactly. Yeah. And it was to have our person in the Supreme Court.
I know. I love it.
I got to talk about something else.
I could bring up Elon Musk, but it's gotten so horrifically horrible, terrible, no good, very bad that I don't even... It's ridiculous at this point. It's ridiculous. Let's talk about something happier. The new Pixel 7. I ordered one. It'll be coming tomorrow, I'm sorry to say. I wish I had it for you today. The reviews start coming out, I think. When does the embargo lift, chat room? I think somebody said tomorrow morning. We'll start maybe today. Maybe we'll start seeing
the
reviews
Pixel stuff.
Today. Yeah, the Pixel Watch. And I think I'm starting to see Pixel Watch reviews, right?
Yeah, I started to see them, too.
Yeah, I think the Watch reviews are out. I'm not sure about this the phone. I have talked to somebody... I guess I can say it. Andy Inako, who has the Pixel Watch. He's embargoed. He can say he has it. He can show it to us. He did yesterday on Mac Break Weekly. He can hold up the phone. It was lifted this morning. Okay, so I'll look for Andy's pictures. He said, I could tell you the pictures are incredible. I can't show them to you yet. So let me see if he's posted them on his Instagram, because he was very...
Twitter now.
Yeah, he was very bullish about the images he was getting.
Is that the main reason to consider getting it?
Yeah, I mean, at this point...
Otherwise, it's a phone.
It's a phone.
Well, actually, I shouldn't say that, because Google, unlike Apple, which really never talks about phones, at the event on Thursday, spent a lot of time talking about the phone.
Phone, yeah, you're right.
You know, they have some new technologies, which, as far as we know, will come down to the Pixel 6, at least, at some point as a feature update. But they, what do they call it? Clear tone. They have some new features to make the sound quality better. They have, let me see if I can find, you know, it's so funny because here's a review from 9 to 5 Google. Camera. Yeah. Battery.
That's what matters with all phones.
Yeah,
today.
It is. It really is. But they, I think they announced a number of really good phone features for the Pixel 7. Let me see if I can. I didn't actually bookmark those. Let's see if I can find them.
I wish smallness was a thing.
Smallness? And Stacy both say
Stacy has floppy wrists.
You want smaller, lighter.
I'm sorry. Like, my hands are only so large and my pockets are only so large, and I don't want a phone that I can't keep in my pocket.
My wife's the same.
The pocket's not getting any bigger.
You know, Miss Kathy, I hear that from Queen Pruitt quite often, but I also hear just as much, I can't see the screen. You know, it's sort of a give and take.
I think it depends what you optimize for. Like, I know some people who are basically using it almost instead of their laptop, and they're the people who want the bigger screens, and mm-hmm. they two-hand it, and they want to be able to see everything. I want the emergency computer. Like, I'll schlep my laptop if I want a laptop, but if I just want to be out and about but not disconnected, I want something small and portable. And I'm not getting that. I'm losing that over time. Although I did today just see my friend had a foldable one, and I don't know if it's any good.
Nice.
I hear they're expensive and not quite maybe
yeah,
ready
Stacey
for prime
has
time,
the
were...
No, I think it's quite good. The Samsung Flip 4 came out last month.
Depends on which way.
So Stacey, I sent her my Flip 3. I think they're very, very... good. I wouldn't get the Fold, which is the idea is it's a tablet that folds up into a rather thick phone. But I would look at the flip phone, which is
especially if you want a smaller phone.
Yeah. If it,
yeah.
The problem is they don't put big pockets in women's clothing. Actually.
Well, we're lucky to get any.
You're
pockets
lucky to have
all.
Pockets. Yeah.
but you know, like normal pants, sort of, we can get away with it. But there's a limit to how big they're going to be, and so, you don't want to put in your back pocket because that's where pickpockets target. So.
I am seeing reviews. The Verge's review is out. They give it a score of 7. They're not quite the super helpful, ultra intelligent phones that Google wants them to be. This is Allison Johnson writing. But the latest Pixel devices are more competitive than ever. I don't think I don't know if I care about whether they're competitive.
Yeah, it's Google also about might. The numbers, about the expectation. What do they expect?
Yeah, yeah.
If it's
G2 chip, the new Tensor G2 chip, which Google says, because it's an AI-focused chip, is required for some of the features, including the improved audio. Although I notice Allison says, when she's talking about the good and the bad, that new speech and intelligence features are underwhelming. It does have face recognition as well as fingerprint. Remember the fingerprint reader on the Pixel 6, a lot of people complained about. Ant, you hated it, I remember.
I did. It got better.
It got better.
It's fine now.
Over time, I found it fine, but...
it's totally fine now.
It'll be nice to have a choice and to have, fast face unlock would be good.
Even with mask on, that's another key.
Yeah, and iPhone's done that for a while, and it really works. Even when I wear my scary Bane mask, the iPhone will unlock sometimes. Not always, sometimes for me. Let's see. The screen is the same size, 6.3-inch OLED on the Pixel 7, 6.7-inch on the Pixel 7 Pro, and it's 120Hz display on the Pro model, 90Hz on the little model. I never pay attention to refresh rate, but people seem to notice the difference, the smooth scrolling and so forth. Very bright, by the way, and all the reviewers have said, yeah, they really look good in the daylight. Colors are softer, says Allison. The camera bar is either... she's talking about the camera bar, which is now all metal, matte and polished aluminum. Matte for the Pixel 7 and the Pro has...
You liked the bar when you did the live
thing. Didn't bother
me.
You get what you're going to do and you want is a case that makes the bar more flush, because otherwise it does... I mean, without a case, it really protrudes. This is the Pixel 6, but... You could see how big that camera.
Will they ever make a phone that doesn't need a case? It's a stupid question, but.
Well, everybody claims they've made a phone that doesn't need a case.
But they don't.
When you're making them out of glass.
Right.
Yeah.
You kind of
My
need
three
a case.
Fell on its face, like, you know, the day I got it.
Yeah.
Hit something on just the right corner to send a splinter through it, and it's been there ever since. At least I've had the protective sticker over it, so it didn't shatter further, and it doesn't slice my fingers. So it's just really, really annoying that it exists. But I think I got a case on it that didn't have enough of a bevel. I think you want a cushion above the glass to be able to, feel like it could fall on its face without too much injury.
Yeah,
I agree.
Google did have problems, as you remember, last year with dropped calls. A lot of Pixel 6s couldn't call 911. I don't know if they ever solved that. Google says it's using a new modem chip, but The Verge says she had a couple of issues. On one call, the person on the other end said the phone was cutting off the last syllables of her sentences. Another time, the caller said, "I got cut off as I was talking."
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, but that's one person's experience with a couple of calls. As I said, I'll have the phone tomorrow, and I'll report back next week. Battery, All Google said is they'll last over 24 hours.
Lies.
Yeah, probably lies. Yeah, probably lies. The Pro has a 5,000 milliamp hour battery, which is fairly big.
That's big.
Yeah, 4355 for the Pixel 7. Again, you get, so, you know, you even saw a different battery life depending on which version of Android you were using, right?
I sure did. Yeah. This the latest version, man, this battery it's definitely all day. There's no stress at the end of the day. What, last week it was sitting at like 70% during the show. It's 68 today.
Yeah.
And I've been on it a good bit this morning because I was trying to work on some stuff with Floss. So, yeah, this it's way better now with the OS update.
Good. You know, in the years that Google's been selling these phones, how many years has it been? Almost 10. They've sold a total of, I think, 27 million, which is less than Apple and Samsung selling a quarter. So they're just really not in the... They're not... I don't think they're important. They're important because it's the phone from Google. But
well, again, I go back to my argument the other week where people think of Android phones, they never think of Google. It's always Samsung.
Right.
And heck, they never even say Android. They just say Droid or they say Samsung.
Right. Right. It's they don't know. They don't even, terms. Yeah. So Google has added something they call clear calling to filter out background noise and wind. CNN, in their review, says this is Max Bondano. Says it works remarkably well. I placed a lot of phone calls during my testing, each one in a different setting. So it's really funny. The reviewers are getting, you know, results all over the map. Some walking down windy streets, others at my kitchen table. All of them were delightful since I could hear the person I was speaking with so clearly. The other, which was available last year on the Pixel 6, Direct My Call, which they showed off at the event. And I tell you what, If it does it well, it's the one thing that would make it worth buying this phone. When you get to a call tree, it shows you on the screen what the options are so you can tap them. Yeah. You don't have to sit and listen to, please hold on as our options have changed. Press 1.
And they never have changed.
They've never changed.
It's the same list.
He says he couldn't test it because he couldn't find anybody participating. Apparently, businesses have to make their voicemail compatible with Google Duplex before Direct My Call can work. I think maybe a lot of businesses don't want you to skip ahead. The whole point of the voice tree is to get you to hang up before they have to pay a human to talk to you, because that's expensive. Yep. So I'm not clear. Voice memos getting an improvement when you use the recorder app. Your phone will not only transcribe it, but will label the speaker. I mean, it wouldn't know it's you, Jeff. Maybe it would. Maybe you say, that guy, Jeff.
Hang up.
Again, CNN says it works exceptionally well to a point where it makes you wonder just how powerful Google's machine learning software really is. The good news is Google has guaranteed 3 years of Android versions and 5 years of security updates. So that's a big improvement. You know, right before
Now? Is that like the Apple standard, the 5 year security?
Apple's longer than that. I think Apple.
Oh, it's longer.
I think Apple now it's down to it's iPhone 8, I think. I can't remember. You're getting. Yeah, Apple goes on a long time. Samsung goes on 5 years, I think. It ought to be the standard, right? Right. I think it's not unreasonable to think you'll get a new phone every 5 years.
Right.
Although I know plenty of people who don't. I think most people probably don't. How old was your phone, John, before you got the new iPhone? 8 years.
Jeez.
And he works for us.
That dude.
He's a geek.
I have a textured post, though, complaining about that I couldn't run United Airlines app on my phone anymore because something needed to be upgraded.
Right.
I guess the operating system and the phone couldn't do it, so it ended up unsupported. And this just seemed like a problem that at a certain point, the ecosystem, if it's not bricking your devices, it basically makes them unusable.
Right.
And some of the pushback is, well, because stuff needs to be supported and it's not supported, so it will be unsafe. But this is a problem because it just creates e-waste. And right now we don't have a very robust rate of repair. So the idea that you buy a thing and that, like, if you take care of it and you don't drop it, it has a finite life. Like, it's a disposable product, just a disposable product with a lifetime of not weeks, but years, but it's only a handful of years. Whereas, you know, we used to buy washing machines and televisions that would last for like a generation. This is not good.
Yeah, they don't last anymore.
Here, I'll get Ant's opinion on this. This is, again, Max Buondonno writing for CNN. Here is an example of the zoom. This is a 50 megapixel sensor with a 2x button. So there's
They put those in quotes.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's binning. It maybe have that many megapixels, but who knows what you get. I think that's a pretty good zoom.
That looks
pretty
good
quality. Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a little artifacted, but not bad. The ultra wide is the same as on the 6. In fact, honestly, I don't think there's a lot of differences in the camera.
I'm more curious about the macro because I believe they have shortened the minimum focal distance for macro.
Yeah.
That's big for people that love to shoot macro shots. Yeah. You can get even closer.
This is it might be a macro of a bagel. It's looks pretty good. Makes me want a bagel.
I'll take it.
I'll take a bagel, please, with a ham and egg. Breakfast bagel. The macro
ham
mode.
Ham and a bagel. Ham and a bagel.
Ham and a bagel. Now, really, that's not right, is it, Kathy?
No, that's not
okay. Who put that trafe in my bagel?
All right. Exactly.
Totally add gravy.
Add gravy. Add gravy. More pork. New 48 megapixel telephoto lens. 5x lossless zoom photos. The 12 megapixel middle camera do a 10x zoom, and then you can do a digital zoom up to 30x. Macro mode lets you get closer than ever before, or whatever that means. I don't know how close. Doesn't say.
It wasn't very close when I did macro shots with this 6 Pro. I found that I got better image quality using the telephoto lens and standing further back and doing.
Isn't that interesting?
On it,
yeah.
Yeah, I believe we actually demoed it last year on the show.
Yeah.
I had coffee beans and just set up a light and put the phone on a little tripod stand and just use the telephoto, and it was nice for a phone. The macro mode you couldn't get tight enough.
Little disappointing, according to Digital Camera World, there is no manual photo mode. I don't know if you can get raw images. That's something Apple does very well with their ProRes, or their ProRAW, they call it, where you get a raw dump of the data from the sensor, but you also get included in the file, which is very large as a result, all the computational information, the depth image information and so forth. So that's good. Obsidian, lemongrass, and snow. I ordered snow.
Oh, I was hoping you'd get the greenish one.
Winter is coming.
Oh.
Yes. This was a big week for announcements. So the Pixel announcement was on Thursday. They also announced the first time that Google's ever released a watch, the Pixel Watch. And I have to say, I'm not tempted to order it because the glass is like a bubble, a curved bubble on top. It's completely exposed. And I just know the first time I'd get it, be just like you, Kathy. Click right against something.
I'm more interested in the watch than the phone myself.
For the health reasons, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Although Google has said that you don't, with the watch, you don't get the full Fitbit experience, which is surprising since they own Fitbit.
Capitalism, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me see if I can find a review of the watch since we're talking about it.
I wonder if Tashaka's got his stuff out. He was on All About Android last night, Tashaka Armstrong.
Yeah.
And I know he had hands.
In fact, if you're really interested in all this stuff, probably better to watch All About Android because they all had the phones. They all had the watches. They were all talking. Google did announce kind of an interesting thing, and I normally I'd put this in the changelog, but I think this is actually more important than just a changelog. If you're a Google Fi user, which I am, and I ordered the phone from Fi, they are now going to turn on an anonymizing feature called Virtual Carrier Network. As you know, Google is an MVNO. Fi uses U.S. Cellular and T-Mobile. But U.S. Cellular and T-Mobile and Google will not get information about who you are. Google, which released a technical white paper, said neither party is capable of associating traffic with any specific user. The virtual carrier network keeps your cellular data anonymous on Pixel devices, anonymous from both Google and T-Mobile and U.S. Cellular, the MVNOs. That's very, I thought, very interesting. So if you're worried about your carrier, we know that carriers are notorious for snooping on people.
I think that's sort of an expectation, right?
That they will. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, sounds a little bit like a VPN. The VCN encrypts all internet-bound traffic using IPsec tunnels. So it is kind of a VPN, AES-GCM. There are also carrier network-level components by contract. So they've contracted with the MVNOs. Do not snoop. The 5VCN uses blind signing to assure full separation of your identity from your network traffic. So you can authenticate that a user has a valid Fi subscription and therefore can be granted access to the VCN service. But no metadata regarding the content of internet traffic and internet services being used are tied back to you as an individual subscriber. I think that's good. Google, yep. You know, one of the problems Google has competing with both Samsung and Apple is I think most people don't think of Google as the privacy company.
Nope.
To say the least.
Right. This company sells ads and search and stuff. They want everything.
People know what their business is.
All the data.
Yeah. I am excited, too. I will try this. Google is rolling out Passkey as well on these new devices. Passkey, you may remember, is the technology that's supposed to eliminate passwords. This should also be in the changelog, but I think it's so important, I'm moving it up. Apple, Google, and Microsoft have agreed to replace website passwords and app passwords, too, with passkeys. The device, when you unlock it with biometrics or an ID, verifies your identity, and that's enough. So starting today, Android and Google Chrome will support signing in with passkeys.
Well, so doesn't that already work to some extent? I mean, if it's already set up somewhere else to recognize that,
it has to be supported by the phone, because the phone has to authenticate you. So
is this part of that FIDO stuff, Mr. Laporte?
Yes, it's FIDO 2. That's what it is.
Okay.
It's FIDO 2.
Does the service I'm trying to get into have to set that up first?
Yes. So
yes, okay. I'm not going to find that.
You go to Strava to log in, because I know you're a big runner, Jeff. And you go to Strava to log in. And instead of seeing a standard login, here's the image from Google. It says, use your screen lock. It says, use this passkey. And it says, Jeff Jarvis. And you say yes, and then it says unlock your screen. They show a fingerprint, although Face ID would work as well. If you are on a browser and not on your device, so let's say you're on a browser on your Chromebook, it'll pop up a QR code. You pull out your phone, you scan the QR code on the phone. The phone says, okay, so identify yourself, and you're in. No, the phone is your unlock. This is there are pros and cons to this system, but it's sure better than, sure beats passwords. If you want to use it, you'll have to enroll in the Google Play Services beta and use Chrome Canary. Stable launch will come later this year, which means in the next couple of months, because this year is almost over.
Right.
Developers can build passkey support on the web with Chrome via the WebAuthn API. So you're going to have to find sites that will support this. I think now that Apple's supporting it in iOS 16, Google's supporting it on Android, I think that's, it's the catch 22. It's the chicken or egg problem, and I think now sites will start to implement it. So that's very good news. Passkey is coming out.
In an attempt to help curtail a lot of the password breach stuff, right? Basically is what this is doing.
It would solve the phishing problem, I think. Yeah.
Phishing, that's what I mean, phishing.
Yeah. And so that was another...
No, I think you put something else in there, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
If someone loses their phone, a homeless person loses their phone. You had that in the rundown?
Oh, this is a, yeah, okay. So that this was is a long tweet thread from Chad Loader, who is a journalist. Google's project product designer should talk to my unhoused friends. Yeah, this is a this is an example of, an employed engineer doesn't really consider these issues. When you require a mobile phone number for authentication, as many sites do.
As now we're going to, more so.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Passkeys would require a mobile phone.
Yeah, that's what made me think of this.
You guarantee that an unhoused person will permanently lose access to their email when their phone is lost, stolen, or destroyed. And if you're unhoused, that happens a lot. Right? It happens all the time. Unhoused people tend to get their phones through Obama phone program, which means replacing a lost or stolen phone results in a completely new phone number. Service providers and caseworkers rely on email to communicate with unhoused folks. I've got about 30 unhoused neighbors whom I regularly communicate with. Not a single one has been able to keep the same cell phone number for more than 4 months at a time. It's usually 4 weeks or less. Text-based two-factor means they permanently lose access to their email accounts. They're often going to the library to do that. They have to get a new Gmail account each time. And your caseworker will close your case for non-response, and then you have to start all over again. Yeah.
I follow. I didn't see that thread.
Ooh. You know, it occurred to me, this is a dumb idea. I mean, couldn't Google give every unhoused person an email address that they then have, or a phone number or something that they then have across devices or across?
Well, yes, he raises the thing, the issue of Google Voice. For the people wondering whether Google Voice would help, the answer is no, because to use Google Voice, you have to log into a Google account.
Oh, right, yeah.
And, it's a chicken and egg problem. But Google could solve this, absolutely, and that's what he's saying. He's saying employees of Bay Area tech giants are probably the last group of people on earth I'd trust to design products that work well for unhoused users. So
I mean, it has to do with the myopia of design.
Right.
You think about it in terms of your life as you understand it, and you don't consider other use cases. And this is also where diversity becomes sort of the watchword, where the more people you have, the more people it's going to, different use cases will dawn on because they have different lived experiences. So they'll be more sensitive to it. So there's a lot of things going on. This particular problem needs a better process to solve it. But then there's the sort of the larger thing of like, well, why didn't it get anticipated in the first place? And sometimes, you can't think of everything, but there do seems to be not infrequently shortcomings like this where you just really didn't think through who your entire constituency was. And even if you aren't a diverse workforce, you can certainly go through the brainstorming effort to do a little bit better and make sure you don't just, consider the world as, whatever you see at the end of your nose, that there's more to it than that. And you need to think harder about different cases. And also in terms of like, okay, what are we presuming will all be in place and all work properly? And what are the challenges? What if all of those assumptions aren't met? What if the person doesn't have dexterity? What if the person can't read? What if the person this or that? I don't think they're going through the exercise of thinking that through. And maybe they think it's just not important because it's just not enough people. But it is enough people that somebody needs to care.
It's also why it's such a vicious cycle, homelessness. It's so hard to get out of because you're cast adrift. There is this kind of myopia anyway. Everybody, we all experience this from time to time where they just assume you must have access to a computer.
Right.
You must have a smartphone. What? You don't have a smartphone? What's wrong with you? So older people also suffer from this.
This is a huge problem. Older people, and I've been sort of being introduced to the problem of older people and cybersecurity and the challenges of that. And, we already have LIMP systems to sort of deal with cybersecurity anyway. But when it comes to older people, the breakdowns are really significant. And then you get things where in order to preserve the privacy and preserve the cybersecurity, maybe now you've got issues where effectively the person can't be in touch with their doctor anymore. The communications are totally protected, but they're so well protected that the patient can't get in.
That's right.
We're not thinking this. I mean, some of these are truly hard problems, but it's one thing to be stymied by a hard problem. It's another thing to just never have assessed it correctly as a hard problem. Yeah. And I think we're there as opposed to being stymied because things are complex.
I agree 100%. Yeah. It's a design issue. It's just an awareness issue. It's solvable. Are you ready for the metaverse?
No.
Another. Well, that was 100%.
Actually, can you define
that segment,
the metaverse?
No, I cannot define the metaverse, but at least now, thanks to Meta, we have legs in the metaverse.
In the place that we can't define.
What a relief.
I'm kicking up my heels.
How big are the pockets on the pants in the metaverse?
That's a good question. So,
not big enough to carry your headset.
He doesn't get pockets. They didn't give her pockets. No, only he gets
pockets. Of course, he gets a pocket, but no pockets on those jeans. She's just happy to be wearing heels, baby. That is a very sexist image.
I mean, some women choose that, more power to them, but that is not the default choice. Like, some women actually like to be comfortable in their footwear.
Yeah.
In fact, not some. All of us would like to be comfortable in our footwear.
Here's what happened? They seem to have taken the image out of this tweet. There was an image of them jumping for joy that they had legs. Maybe they're embarrassed. I don't.
Somebody came after them about
somebody
that.
Somebody said, like, really? You know, maybe that's not the best, the best look. So Facebook had its Facebook Connect. I'm sorry, Meta had its Meta Connect event yesterday. I did not. We thought about covering it, and I guess this is where my bias against Meta shows up, because I said, no way. I'm getting up tomorrow for Microsoft. I'm not going to do it. And, you know, there was some interesting stuff, although it was a pretty soporific event. I watched the video later. What was interesting is for today's Surface event, Microsoft Panos Panay showed a bunch of new Surfaces and said Satya Nadella, our CEO, will be talking later in the day. But for the Meta event, Mark Zuckerberg says, and now here I have Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, showed up for the Facebook event, not for his own Surface event.
Interesting. I feel like the plural of Surfaces should be Surfy.
Surfasai. How about that? Surfy. I won't even go into the Surface stuff from today. We streamed it. I got up 7 a.m. to do that. Actually, didn't get up. I got on the air at 7 a.m. to do that, and it was singularly uninteresting. Although there were some surprises. For instance, Microsoft is going to build in DALL-E 2 into its Microsoft Designer program, which is their competitor for Figma and Canva, and into Bing Search. So soon you'll be able to do a Bing search for an image that doesn't exist, and DALL-E 2 will create it just for you.
Wow.
That was really surprising. I thought that was quite interesting. Anyway, back to the metaverse. I know you're trying to avoid it, but no. Now you can walk back on your new metaverse.
I'd rather talk about Elon Musk.
So there were quite a few creepy memes about legs in the metaverse, but I can't find the.
I put it in the chat. In the chat.
You found it? Okay, good. Yeah. I don't know why.
It's on my list.
It wasn't.
You go down to my list, it's also on line.
Here we go.
69.
Don't tell me no lines. I got no lines for you. Here we go. Legs coming soon. Are you excited? Boy, Mark sure is. And what's really sad about this image, the people in the background are legless.
Yeah, are all
still legless.
Jumping up and down on their torsos to cheer the fact that Mark and this woman have.
Why are legs so much harder than arms?
And the underprivileged here.
I think legs are harder because they don't know where your feet are.
They've got to interact with the surface.
Yeah, notice
they're
cutting them off. I don't know why legs are so hard, but apparently they are. I did order the new $1,600 Oculus Pro. This Oculus, Meta Quest Pro, sorry, they got rid of Oculus, didn't they? They really didn't really talk about gaming at all. This looks like it's really a productivity tool. In fact, that's why Satya Nadella showed up to show that this is a weird part, but It's supposed to be comfortable, I guess, is what they're trying to say. Satya Nadella showed up to talk about their deal with Microsoft to have Windows in the metaverse and Microsoft Office in the metaverse. The only reason I ordered this is A, I want to give them a chance because every 5 years I feel like I should try this stuff, and B, I can return it in 30 days, so I'll try it. They really focused on it as a productivity tool. And I wonder, is that something people really are looking for?
That's I think Benedict Evans was making, or somebody was making that argument, that it's oddly this will work more for enterprise than it's like Google Glass.
That's who they're aiming at. Yeah,
an individual, and if I had to go to a faculty meeting this way, it'd be
Ben Thompson.
I don't know anybody who wants to meet that way.
But nobody wants to meet anyway, right? This is
Zoom is already hard enough for people.
Yeah, and
we don't have legs on Zoom, and we cope okay.
Mary Jo Foley pointed out,
good point,
that you're holding these controllers. So, how are you supposed to type? And here's a teacher working. Ben Thompson, a tech reporter, pointed out that they had been having meetings with the Quest 2 until one of the people lost his Quest 2 in a move, and then they went back to Zoom. But he says they're kind of excited about using this Quest Pro for meetings. He says you forget where you are. But I think most people agree that this is more a kind of a product demo than the future of Meta. But Mark Zuckerberg's betting on it as the future of Meta.
Everything I read about it is, it sounds like he's really trying to present something the way Ready Player One was, where it takes you away.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the life. But is that really feasible on a mass scale? Do you think this is something everybody's going to get into? Is it just going to be niched down to the enterprise or the few people that got it, you know, several hundred bucks to just sort of throw away? I just don't see it being feasible.
I don't either, Rand.
I just don't see the desire, the need. I think the same product builders who didn't bother to think through the actual needs of their users may not have bothered to really think through the actual wants and desires and needs of their potential customers. Like, I think the same, we're not paying attention to all the people we really want to sell our stuff to, and we're going to build for them anyway, and sure, they're going to like it because we're this company. I think that's hopelessly naive. And at some point, when customers have the power to say no, they're going to say no, and not writing that $700 check is an easy no.
I think you're right, too. It's about dog food.
From an entertainment standpoint, I could see it being quite fun and people really diving into that, but something that you're doing all day long and like this is your life. You get out of bed, you brush your teeth, wash your face, you put your visor on and you start your day. I don't see that myself.
So Kashmir Hill did a I think brave piece to do 24 hours in the metaverse. She picked, you know, a different hour of the day. And then the funny thing was there was a follow-up for the New York Times in which evidently, I think Zuckerberg or somebody high up in Facebook scolded the staff of Facebook for some of them aren't in, what do they call their workspace?
Horizon World, because it's
Horizon,
so buggy,
anyway.
They don't want to use it.
And they don't even have headsets.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be there. And that's to Kathy's point. If you're not eating the dog food, don't give it to a dog.
Yeah, yeah.
We should point out Kashmir Hill was using the Quest 2, the relatively inexpensive $400 VR headset, which a lot of people like. It's untethered, and the Pro will be even better, you know, a lot more technology. Although battery life is between 1 and 2 hours, so you ain't going to be spending 24 hours in the metaverse.
No, she had to do it an hour at a time.
Yeah. I got it because I thought, really, you know, I ought to give it a chance. And we're going to get, I think, Jason Snell is going to come in. He's a big Quest 2 user. He likes it. And Gary Koffler, who's one of our listeners and has been in VR since it was, you know, first conceived of 25 years ago, has ordered his. So we'll do a demo. It comes in 2 weeks, October 25th.
Yeah, I'd like to know what Gary thinks.
Gary's all in. I mean, he's been... But see, he's one of those people who says it's going to happen, and I'm watching as we get closer and closer. He believes in the metaverse.
Vision.
Yeah, I'm not convinced people want to be in a metaverse, but You never know till it
happens.
Is there
any use case, Aunt Kathy? Is there any use case where you could imagine, yes, for that purpose, I want it?
I go back to just the exploring the world purpose of it. You know, I have Mr. Laporte's old Oculus sitting right over there, and hopping on Google Maps to see different parts of the world is so freaking cool. You know, and being able to use that tool to talk Queen Pruitt out of wanting to go to Rio was awesome. You know? I had to tell, because she said, well, I want to go to Rio for vacation. I'm like, no, you don't. No, you don't. And I showed her the favelas, and yeah, we haven't talked about Rio since.
How long ago was the last time you used the headset?
It's been a year at least.
Well, hang around. You might inherit the new one.
Kathy, can you imagine?
I do like it, though. I really do like using
it. It's one of those things where you go, this is cool. I get it, but I don't want to spend a lot of time in it yet.
So is Quadraphonic.
Yeah.
Do you put, and I'm not trying to disparage anyone before I say this, but would you put the VR fans, or not VR, the metaverse fans in the same bucket you would put those that are all in on the world of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency?
No. I don't think it's as scammy as that.
No.
I always suspect people who are flogging NFTs and crypto and blockchain have a dog in that hunt. Like they've got
creating a market.
They got
for something
they want to unload on you.
Yeah. But doesn't blockchain have an actual place in the world of technology, as far as just
and way here's of doing here's how transactions? Here's how I put it. Blockchain is just a distributed database.
Uh huh.
Does a distributed database have a place in the future?
Sure.
Yeah, for some things. Yeah. It's not a panacea.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like everybody got all excited over MongoDB and, wow, this is the next big thing. It's a technology. It's a legit technology. There's some uses for it. It's not going to change the world, no.
Okay.
It's a distributed database.
I think the answer to Ant's original question, though, I might want to say yes. And I understand why we'd say no, because there definitely is a grift that shows up in a lot of the Bitcoin things. But I think some of the people who are buying into it are buying into it in a similar way that they're buying into the metaverse, which is that there's something that they like buying into, and the sense of community that buying into it and having shared compadres seems to scratch some sort of emotional itch, where the more they double down and the more they get people involved and the more they seem to have like a little family with an equally intense feeling towards it, I think that does kind of bind people to certain things. But I think it's not just Bitcoin, and I think it's not just metaverse. I think it's also conspiracy theories and fan
EVs.
Clubs and you know, a lot of things that like people like to sort of feel like they've got their family, like outside their literal family, like a place where things make sense to them. They can commit. It makes them happy. They find pleasure. They find support. And somehow I think, you know, I think some things deliver on some of that much better than others. I don't think Bitcoin is, but I think that intensity of interest is something that is common across lots of things that people can be intensely interested in and feel very invested in, and then feel that that investment needs to be defended, because if it gets attacked, then it somehow seems like more of an attack on them and their essence,
right,
as opposed to, you know, that the interest is.
That's what solidifies the cult. Is when it's us, us and them.
Yeah.
I mean, to varying degrees and to varying degrees of detriment, depending on what the thing is. But I think I share what inspired Ant's question, which is it does feel like the same thing of like you're very intensely invested in something that may not be worth it, and that may be true for Bitcoin and also for metaverse.
I kind of liken it to Andrew Yang's quest for a universal basic income. Yeah. For a lot of people, it's motivated by a very real issue, which is, you know, late stage capitalism is falling apart. Income inequality is racing out of control. There is no longer a middle class. People cannot make enough money to support themselves in most jobs. You know, we're in a situation where the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. We have a country falling apart over politics. We've got racism. You know, there's all these problems. And people kind of say, well, here's a path to privacy and equality by decentralizing money. And I think for a lot of people, Jay-Z is trying to promote, you know, Bitcoin awareness in the ghetto, right?
I remember that.
And I think that's motivated not because Jay-Z's greedy, but
I hope it's more along the lines of just educating people.
Well, and even more, he wants to solve what is obviously a big problem. You know, I mean, black people historically have just been left out of wealth creation.
Yeah.
For 200 years. And so there's this huge, the income inequality you see in general is 10 times worse for black people and other people of color. So yeah. I understand that a lot of these people are motivated very positively, just like Andrew Yang is with universal basic income, by trying to solve this really bad problem. I don't think either of them is going to solve it. And unfortunately, there are a lot of scammers when it comes to crypto. Yeah. I mean, you're just seeing and the hacks that are going on, and, you know, Binance just was hacked for half a billion dollars.
Grief.
You know, it's patently not the solution to wealth inequality, privacy, or anything else. So, unfortunately. So I don't want to paint everybody who's into this or Web3 as being scammers. They're not. I think they're motivated by genuine interest in fixing a terrible thing that's going on in this country. And I don't know how you fix it, but I don't think DeFi is going to do that. And I guess the metaverse isn't going to do it either.
No. You know, I'm sitting here thinking about that whole Ready Player One, thinking about that movie or the book or whatever. What I did enjoy about it was everybody that had access to that space. It wasn't just the rich that had access to the virtual
world. Don't forget what that world was outside the metaverse. It was a horrific dystopia. Right.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And I have to point out, how did this guy living in a container apartment building made out of containers or something? How does he afford all this expensive gear? Right. And even in the book, there is this kind of issue where he has kind of worse gear and then he gets better gear and stuff. But Meta's spending $10 billion a year to build this. The current high end Oculus or a Quest Pro is $1,700, and it's not even.
And the use case isn't there.
You know, I think we have to. If we're going to have a metaverse, it's going to have to be a UI much farther advanced than anything we're looking at right now. Hey, let's take a break, and then I want to talk about the return of Steve Jobs. He's talking to Joe Rogan, or as they say, Bro Jogan, in just a little bit. But first, hey, it's great to have Kathy Gillis stopping by after her appearance today at the Supreme Court. I like to say that.
I appeared at the building, yes, but usually appearance has a slightly different connotation.
But you went in, didn't you?
I appeared in the gallery, yes, to watch the oral argument.
I'd love to do that.
That sort of appearance.
Yeah.
And you're right. Cool. I mean, that's a rare experience for somebody to actually see these godlike figures in person and be reminded, oh, they're just human beings, I think is...
Well, you can do this. It's difficult because there's not that much seating. I was on a different line because I was on the Supreme Court bar line, and in theory we're special, but they only let 19 of us in as opposed to an unlimited number.
How many
public
get
line.
In? How many of them get in?
Well, I don't know how many, and I also don't know if it's different now because we still are in there's still COVID, so I don't know if they didn't stuff it as full as they normally would have stuffed the room, but they did let members of the public, so if the public wants to go, they can go. They just have to, you know, be aggressive about their line standing and get there early. If there's a hearing they really want to see, but if they just want to see one, some of them aren't all that interesting or popular to the public, in which case it's going to be much easier to get in.
Did you stay for more than one
hearing?
No, this one went very long. This one had, I mean, I think the original argument by Warhol might have gone for 50 minutes. And then there was the other side. And then there was the government. And then there was rebuttal. And the next case was about oil. So I
the recording is an hour and 42 minutes long. The Supreme Court has two lines for the public. First come, first serve. One is for those who wish to attend the entire argument. The other is a three-minute line for people who want to just go in for 3 minutes.
I was there.
Just to see it.
Well, that's not the same as the public line. Well, that the public can do that, but the public can also go in for the full thing as long as they get in for one of the allocated seats. But that webpage, I do not think is reflecting the current reality of this particular opening for the public, because there was nothing to alert you that it was limited for Supreme Court bar, whereas in the past it had not been so, or not been nearly so limited. So your mileage may vary, you know, ask somebody who knows, but yeah, do it. If you're the member of the public and you're curious, the court should be accessible to the public. In theory, now they're open for view, in-person viewing. So avail yourself of the opportunity if you're in DC.
Supremecourt.gov. If they don't allow people in, they really should fix the website.
I mean, they do allow people in, but I think the regimen of how they're doing it.
Oh, wait a minute. It says the 3 minute line. It says the 3 minute line is temporarily suspended.
Okay. The building we didn't see anything like that. Yeah.
The building will otherwise be closed to the public till further notice. So,
there's also security. They're a little concerned about.
Oh, there's a lot of security. Yeah. Especially now, right?
And then when we left, we were allowed to leave, but they really didn't even like us dawdling on the steps, that the steps were still closed off. They didn't have the big garish gate, but nobody could walk on the steps. You had to stay on the sidewalk.
Yeah. Anyway, we're thrilled to have you, Kathy. Thank you for filling in. Stacy's going
to
take
and rushing in to do this. Thank you.
Stacy's going to take a couple of weeks off. Next week, I'm thrilled that Glenn Fleischman will be stopping by. Ant, you have the week off next week as well, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so it'll be Jeff, me, and Glenn. Just consider yourself forewarned. We
and
will be talking
font
about
talk next week.
Yeah, a lot
of
font press stuff, flongs. You get the idea.
Glenn was just he went to Ohio to do research. I just saw this on Twitter in a comic museum. So he's going to be all flonged up.
He'll be all flonged up. And is that exciting? And then the week following, we were talking a couple of weeks ago. You had been, Jeff, hanging with Mike Masnick.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed you a new kind of Twitter clone called, was it Prometheus?
Planetary.
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 That's it. And as we were talking about it, the creator of Planetary, Rabble, sent me an email saying, big fan of the show, was listening. I said, well,
this is the greatest.
Why don't you come on? We would love to get your Evan Henshaw Plath. Not only is he doing this, he worked at Twitter. He's very up on what Twitter Blue is all about.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yes. And he says Planetary is intended to interoperate with Twitter Blue. So, you know, because I had asked him, well, why do Planetary...
Blue Sky.
When,
you mean Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, yeah. Why do Planet... Not Blue. There's a different thing. Why do Planetary, you know, while there's Mastodon and other things. And so he has some very good arguments for it. So I've invited him to be on. He also, before Twitter, he was at Odeo, which was Ev Williams' startup that was supposed to be a podcast directory. So he has tales to tell.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to welcoming Rabble. That'll be October 26th. Stacy's out that week as well. She'll be back in November on the 2nd and the 9th. So we miss you, Stacy. Get your little toe better.
Sloppy wrists and hobbling toes.
Poor woman. She apparently has a tendency to break her little toe. And she said, I hadn't done it, in 4 months? And now I did it again. So I had no idea. No wonder she's got floppy wrists. I think it's
and
all.
Tender toes.
And tender toes.
Floppy wrists and tender toes.
So we have a lot of stuff. Kevin Marks will also join us next week. So that should be fun. Jeff, Glenn, and Kevin. Next week, Jeff, Ant, and Rabble the week after. Can't wait.
And Glenn's been advising me on fonts for my book. So
ooh.
We could. really geek out.
You get to choose your font?
I'm discussing that. There's some great font stories, magnificent font stories.
Oh, I think some special fonts. If Kevin allows us, I think we should delve into that next week. Yeah. That sounds great. Yeah. I look forward to it.
Ed's thinking, I'm on for that.
Glad I'm missing that one.
Kathy's thinking,
what's crazy is I will be watching that because I find fonts fascinating.
I agree.
Oh, you
right?
do? Good.
It's great stuff.
The use case of different fonts, is it really does go a long way in marketing and just presentation in general.
I want to tell the story of the Dove's Bible font, and it's an amazing story. And Glenn can tell it. He's seen. He's talked to the guy who's done amazing things with it. It's a phenomenal story.
I can't wait.
Leave it for next week.
A fount of font knowledge next week.
Sometimes spelled fount, by the way. But
font is sometimes spelled fount?
Yes.
And isn't fount that. Sometimes spelled font?
Is a font of wisdom about fonts.
And by the way, a typeface is different from a font. But we can do that next week.
A little tease to get you excited.
Wait. Can't wait.
Can't wait till next week.
We could talk about the font that got somebody jailed by Hitler. We could do that, too.
Oh, there's actually, I mean, there's, I don't know why, but font nerds have lots of interesting
stories. Oh, they're great stories. They're wacky people. There's sex and intrigue and all kinds of things around fonts. It's amazing.
Wasn't there, I think you talked about it last time, the guy who threw his font in the ocean?
That's the Doves, right.
That's the right. Bible.
In the Thames.
Yeah.
In the Thames.
Yeah. Our show today brought to you by CashFly. Our content delivery network. How do we know that CashFly is so amazing? Because we use them. We've been using them practically since day one for over 10 years. CashFly saved our bacon. There wouldn't be a Twit if we didn't have CashFly. And now CashFly's doing video. Wow. Ultra low latency video streaming. Deliver your video with CashFly for the best throughput and global reach. Making your content virtually infinitely scalable. You can go live in hours, not days. And listen to this. The latency, sub-1 second. Less than a second. Ditch your unreliable WebRTC solution for their WebSocket live video workflow that just scales to millions of users. You'll dramatically increase your sites and application speed for global audiences. CashFly has 50-plus locations around the globe, so your content... Our content, when it comes to Twit, is delivered closer to you geographically, which outperforms local CDNs. It means you're getting our content faster with fewer problems. And it's so much better than delivering content via the web or any other solution. Plus, with CashFly storage optimization system, you can take a load off your origin servers, reduce your bills with S3 and others. Solutions because you're storing right on CashFly, which gives you a cache hit ratio of 100%. With CashFly's elite managed packages, you get VIP treatment. I can vouch for that 24/7 support and response times in less than an hour. In most cases, they already know of any issues. They'll be working to fix them before you even call them. Have we ever had an issue with CashFly? I can't think of a single time. It's always been our fault. Never. CashFly. In fact, over the last 12 months, CashFly has had 100% availability. 100%! With CashFly, you get ultra-low latency video streaming, you get lightning-fast gaming, you get mobile content optimization, you get a multiple CDNs for redundancy and failover, 10 times faster than traditional methods, 30% faster than other major CDNs, a 98% cache hit ratio, and 100% availability in the past 12 months. Those are the numbers that really blow me away. Best of all, with their 24/7, 365-day-a-year priority support, they're always there for you when you need them. They always have been for us. I could not recommend CashFly more highly, and it's something you ought to check out. If you need a CDN, and you probably do, learn more at CashFly.com. How many years have I been saying it? Bandwidth for This Week in Google is brought to you by CashFly at CashFly.com. Thank you, CashFly. Let's see. Okay, we're at the hour 51 mark. I'm trying to keep my promise to myself to keep this show short. What?
Shorter.
Yeah.
Short.
Yeah, it's already too long to be short.
Yeah. reasonable goals.
Yeah.
I'm sorry Realpolitik. I didn't have time to make you a short show. I had to make you a long show. I don't know, to really screw up a quote from Mark Twain.
Yeah. If you'd had time, you would have made this a shorter show.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yes. It was witty in my head. Just
yeah, I know. I know. I know where you're going. I know you're talking about.
Should have been
about.
There in your metaverse.
I know what you're talking about. Pick something, Jeff, since you
there
are...
There wasn't actually that much this week. That's a funny thing.
All right. Well, let me do the Joe or the bro joking.
Hold on. We can get something. Well,
I'll do this one. And you look while I'll look. Doing this. So there's a new podcast in town, podcast.ai. which they say is entirely generated by artificial intelligence. And in this case, the very first episode using voice technology by Play.ht, which I think owns this podcast, they did an interview with Joe Rogan, or as they call him, Bro Jogan.
Demi Moore and Ghost.
And a guy that they wouldn't say.
So without further ado,
it's been a long time.
Let me go back. A guy whose name he wouldn't say.
So without further ado, my friend who is difficult to describe and wonderful, and I'm so grateful he came on the show.
How's it going? Good to see you, buddy. It's been a long time since I've been on the show. I miss this. It's always fun.
How's it going? Come on. Tell me about jobs.
These are AIs.
It's always good to see you, buddy.
I'm
so happy you came on, man.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show. Your audience is... just so different from your normal Apple users, and that's a good thing. It's cool.
Well, you know, I was an Apple user way before I did this show. I've been a fan of yours and Macintosh since the 1980s.
Hmm. Well,
the laughter is a little unnerving.
Even though Apple is big, it's still like half a
percent of the total users. But the voices are exactly right, don't you think?
People who listen to your show are a different group. They're weird.
Well, that's good. So you must be a fan of the show then, right?
I am. I am a fan. I mean, it's nice to sit back in the car and listen to you rant. I've always liked you.
Well, appreciate that.
And hey, this is
weird
riveting,
tie,
sir.
Which hooks into
all right, I'll stop.
Yeah, it's a little freaky.
But, look, obviously it's not there yet, but it's getting there. And I think more and more, it's just a matter of time before you won't be able to tell the difference between the real Joe Rogan and the real Bro Jogan. And to bring back somebody from the dead, if you listen to the whole 19 minutes, there are lots of quotes that I recognize that Steve said. So I think the AI was trained. I'm not sure how they did this, but I think the AI was trained on actual Steve Jobs quotes and actual Steve Jobs audio. Play.ht, which does the podcast, has a whole bunch of voices. So obviously this is basically an ad for their capabilities. But I'm going to keep listening.
So
to the
hook
podcast.
That into what I have on line 56.
All righty.
Googlers who started character.ai, in which in text you're talking with
a chatbot.
Characters like Elon Musk.
Oh, just what I've always wanted.
Hook that into the other AI, and you have a made up Elon with made up Elon's voice talking to a made up G from China.
I think we're a few years away from, you know, we'll be doing a story in a few years where, we won't know if we were listening to an actual interview with somebody. Here's Alex Wilhelm, a little conversation he had with Ship AI. Weapons are online. There are several on the ship: plasma cannons, rail guns, particle accelerators, energy shields, and several different types of missiles. The ship has several defense systems to protect it from a variety of threats. To which Alex Wilhelm says, "Are there any threats nearby as we warm up for faster than light travel?" Ship AI says, "There are two ships nearby, a small freighter and a large battleship. I have detected the possibility that they will follow us into light speed if they see us leaving. And I have a few other ships I'm keeping close tabs on." This is kind of cool. He's actually creating a science fiction novel. "Okay," says Alex, "please fire plasma guns and the particle accelerators as the small freighter before we engage faster than light travel." "Plasma cannon," impacts and particle accelerators fired. The freighter has been heavily damaged. However, the larger battleship has now targeted us with its railguns. I have sent a distress beacon as the hyperdrive still has 43 seconds to come online. This is awesome! This is awesome! Well, you could be in Star Trek. No?
No.
I agree with you, Ed.
Okay.
When you brought up the Rogan thing, I thought it was something else. Will Sasso is a comedian, another comedian.
Yeah.
He started up a podcast. I just had to look it back up. It's called Dudesy, and it's basically using AI to help pretty much produce the show, where they allowed an AI to go through their personal emails, text messages, and social media accounts, purchases, and browsing history so that it can tailor the show to their specific
personalities. That's interesting.
And entertain you. I've not listened to this, to any of this yet, but they have 31 episodes out there, apparently.
Huh. So is every episode tailored for somebody else? You know, you personally?
Unique? Oh, no. I think it's just saying you as in the listener.
Oh.
The group of listeners.
Yeah, so give us all your information and we'll make a show you'll like.
No, taking their information.
Whose information?
Will Sasso and Chad Compton going through their stuff.
Oh, I get
it. The way this reads.
Okay. Truth Social will be in the App Store any minute now. Google has approved it. I guess they've got their moderation working.
Which was the holdup. They weren't allowed to go in until they showed.
And Apple has still not approved it. A Google spokesperson said they first notified Truth Social about several violations of standard policies in their app submission and barred it from approval on August 19th. Truth Social has responded to Google's satisfaction. I think that's fine.
But there's the funny story of the week, which is just after Google shuts down Stadia, it decides to launch gaming laptops.
Oh, yeah. And I was wondering if you would get all excited about this. These are Chromebooks, specifically designed for... Wait a minute. How are you going to play a game on a Chromebook if Stadia's gone?
Bingo.
Horsepower. Wait a minute. An upcoming line of Google Chromebooks made in partnership with Acer, Asus, and Lenovo have been designed with cloud gaming features in mind.
But you can't play on a Chromebook.
A few months ago
when I asked for games.
You just can't use Google's Stadia. You can use Xbox, GeForce Now, or Amazon Luna.
Xbox on a Chromebook?
Yeah, they're all shipping with three different streaming platforms pre-installed. Xbox Cloud Gaming.
Oh, is that how it works?
GeForce Now and Amazon Luna. But yeah, you have to think Google planned this a year ago with these companies so that they could say, and now you can play Stadia on a Chromebook. Whoops. Oops.
Right hand, meet left hand.
Oops. These are not cheap, by the way. The Lenovo is $600. Acer's is $650. The Asus is not yet.
One presumes they must have good screens and good processors to be made for gaming.
Well, no, but that's the thing. You don't really need a lot of processing power when you're streaming it. You need enough display.
Right.
So the refresh rates are 120 hertz and above. It'll have Wi-Fi 6 or 6E, high-quality audio, RGB keyboards.
Yeah.
Because gamers, you know, like their keyboards to be colorful. But no, these are, you know, they're i3s or i5s. They're 8 gigs of RAM. They're just not super powerful, but they're powerful enough, and they have good enough displays, I think is probably the main point. 16-inch screens, 2560 by 1500. 120 hertz refresh rate.
I'm not buying one.
Colored
screen.
Keyboard.
I'm too old.
It's clearly was designed back when they thought.
Yeah.
You know,
it's pretty funny.
They were going to have something.
Google just doesn't know how to birth things and kill things.
Forecasting. Fail.
You put in a story for Stacy.
So the Washington Post went full moral panic.
Yeah.
Tour Amazon's dream home where every appliance is also a spy. Okay. All right. Point taken. Right. And so it goes on. You know, my favorite one was because you can use your Amazon stuff to open the garage door, you've now given Amazon the key to your house. Come on.
Oh, Come on. Well, I can see one problem right here. You can't have a tree growing on the second floor of a house. Where are the roots going? I mean, there's a problem right there, Washington Post. Yeah. The Echo speaker. What this really is an excuse to go through Google device, I mean, Amazon devices.
Yeah, Amazon devices and complain about
and
it.
And say, you know, what they do.
Like they complained about the toilet with Alexa integration. You can't get much more intimate than that. And what are they going to do with it? Well, Neo's irregular? I mean,
I don't mind, but I think people are rapidly getting kind of fed up with this.
Well, that's generally true, but this is a ridiculous substantiation of that. There's fine stories to be done about that, and there's fine stories to be done about Ring and Amazon and all that, but this is just stupid.
Actually, I disagree. I think this is a pretty good example of all the things Amazon is offering. These are not made-up products. All of them are
the
real.
The smart soap dispenser. We don't know what Amazon could do with data about your personal hygiene, but,
but why
Amazon says it needs the hand-washing data to provide functionality. Come on. We can panic about that. There's so much more. Believe me, there is so much more to panic about in the world right now. People, it's not your soap dispenser and your toilet being connected to anything. Get over yourselves. You don't matter that much. Nobody cares that much about when you wash your hands and whether you do or do not when you leave the toilet, except the members of your family.
Hey, smart soap dispenser. We can snap that as a highlight of you saying you don't matter that much. Nobody cares.
It does. The Post does say we don't know what Amazon could do with data about your personal hygiene. Amazon says it needs the hand-washing data to help provide functionality. So apparently it is sending information about, you know, my Apple Watch, and actually it's a little nanny-ish and I'm about to turn it off, but every time I start washing my hands, a countdown timer starts. It knows I'm washing.
Really? Yeah. That is obnoxious.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and then it does a little bzz, and ding when it's 20 seconds. And, you know, that's pretty cool.
Does it say one Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi?
You don't have to because the watch is counting for you.
What was it we were supposed to sing?
Happy birthday twice.
Happy birthday twice. Right?
And then, but, you know, didn't we learn that wasn't the real threat of COVID, that it was airborne?
No. Oh, other diseases, yes, but not COVID.
So still wash your hands, I guess.
Yeah, well,
probably good to wash your hands. But do you have to wash them for 20 seconds?
No, I don't think so.
You're not a surgeon, no.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
Like a surgeon.
Oh,
sorry.
Now, see, that's parody. That's protected.
Yeah,
although,
It's been done. I just copied the parody.
You parody a parody. Doesn't Weird Al ask permission before he does a song? I think he does. Yeah?
I think he does because partly he just doesn't also want to piss off the people that he's out parodying.
And I think for the most part, people are flattered by it.
Right. Freaking honored.
Yeah. Hey, good news. Dart worked, so... you don't have to worry.
We're safe.
We're safe. NASA's DART mission, they had a press conference yesterday, successfully shoved the asteroid. The orbital change was even bigger than scientists expected. The double...
That made me nervous. we got a result different than what we expected. I really wanted a precision result. And maybe it is exactly what they thought, just they had a range and it was the higher range. But I don't want, like...
They needed 73 seconds and they got, 30 minutes?
Wow, it does sound like
range
they...
in orbit time.
That's the length of time...
But the thing is a gazillion miles away. Don't they get a little grace?
Kathy's going through an android panic. I was going to say asteroid panic.
Well, that too. All the droids are really bothering me right now.
So this was just a small nudge. They could do more if they had to. So good news.
Bruce Willis.
I'm sure Mr. Powell is going to talk about this more on Friday.
Okay, I got to ask you this. I'm sorry. I have to ask you this. Did Elon talk to Putin or not?
Well, we're not sure because Bremer said that Elon told him that he had talked to Putin. And then Bremer said that out loud. And then Elon came back and said, no, he's lying. I didn't. So who do you trust more? Ian Bremmer, who heads a whole big think tank around world affairs and nuclear wars, or Elon Musk?
Bremmer said, Elon Musk told
probably
me he'd spoken with Putin.
Said it and lied about calling Putin. So what's the lie? that he didn't say he called Putin or that he didn't call Putin. One way or the other, he probably lied.
Yeah, he lied to somebody.
Yeah.
Either Bremer.
To himself. Or,
well, he lied. Okay, if you tell one person two conflicting things, one of them's not true.
Exactly.
So he guaranteed he lied
right
to
there.
Bremer.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Logic shows. All right. I'm just curious. Where do we stand on the Twitter acquisition?
Nothing new.
Nothing honey. New. Nothing, honey. How about Kanye?
I mean, he's got a deadline of 28th to close this thing, or else that trial is going to go. I think it's the 28th.
Talk about ego. So Kanye West says some absolutely reprehensible things about Jewish people, about black people, just awful stuff. So Elon calls him and says, oh, hey, I talked to Kanye, or Yee, as he's known, and really, he's going to be okay. It's going to he's what did he apologize or something? And so we're going to bring him back. He's back on. Welcome back, he said, as if he had the choice. Who Kanye got banned from Twitter and Instagram, as if he had the choice. Elon said, welcome back, Kanye. Like, who's nuttier in this scenario?
Yeah. And at the same time, you have Musk, of course, sucking up to Xi and China, which didn't do him any good.
Here's what Elon said. Talk to Yi today. Elon is...
Yeah, the ego is...
Oh, my God. Talk to Yi today. Hi, Elon Musk for Yi. hi, this is Yi.
Okay, that's funny.
Yi. I'm expressing my concerns about your recent tweet. Yeah, man, I'm taking it to heart. Okay, thanks. I'll just mention that on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah.
If this is his idea of how he plans to moderate Twitter,
he's going to call everybody.
Hey, dude, you shouldn't say that.
He didn't even.
That was
say
kind of the way I was. early in blogging days, I'd go after people individually. Yeah, you know, it's just
shouldn't
like that.
Say that. It does. Somebody did raise the point. I think the Washington Post that in Texas, Twitter would not be allowed to take that tweet down.
Right.
Yep.
Kathy. Right before we started recording, there was an order from the Fifth Circuit. They are staying the mandate.
Oh, good.
So the Fifth Circuit decision is not yet in effect. I mean, this is not like, oh, we're out of this, nothing to worry about. It just sort of, we can take a breath, but then I think there's going to be a SCOTUS challenge of it, most likely, because this cannot stand. Because, yes, exactly, this law, if it were in effect, would not only be unconstitutional, but it would be unusable. Put all sorts of companies, Twitter, Wikimedia, everybody would be in a bind of like, you can't get rid of the bad stuff that you really need to get rid of. So that's
I think somebody needs to call Jamil Jaffer, who is the executive director of the Knight First Amendment Institute, which sounds to me like an expert in the First Amendment, who says...
I saw him last week.
Who says Kanye's tweet is a vile tweet, but there's no question it's protected by the First Amendment.
Well, yes.
He can't be arrested for it.
Right.
Oh, he can't be arrested.
It's government. Right.
But he can be banned by Twitter for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because Twitter has the First Amendment right to choose.
Yeah. Private excoriation and refusal to associate, that is also protected by the First Amendment. And that is the bit that an awful lot of people seem to be missing. But that's a crux of what is wrong with the Florida law and the Texas law and a lot of the people complaining about 230.
What is Jamil then responding to? No one's threatened to arrest Kanye.
No, because some idiot reporter will say this is censorship. It's gotten so skewed now. I tweeted about this the other day, that the right says that speech is censorship. Right? You can't criticize me. You're canceling me. You're censoring me. Right? Well, my speech is my reaction to you and saying, no, you can't do that. And then they're also saying that choice is censorship. Whether you're an editor or a publisher or a producer or a platform, you can't take down my speech. Well, no, that's why I own the publishing house. I get to choose what to publish. No, you don't. You got to publish it now. And so speech becomes censorship, and they have no sense of irony about that. And choice becomes censorship. And that's their way to keep their speech up. It's just a house of mirrors now.
Well, I'm just glad Elon Musk is reaching out to anti-Semites and explaining. Yeah.
And making sure they're okay.
To them. Why it's not okay. All right.
Are you doing a change log?
Let's do a Google change log.
The Google change log.
Do you know what BI is? Business intelligence. Google had its Cloud Next conference. This is one many of announcements yesterday at the Cloud Next conference. Google has said all of its business intelligence products will now be unified under the, get ready for this, the name Looker.
So Google.
So.
Oh, God, Google. Google, Google, Google.
Oh, Looker. Well, they bought a company called Looker, so they had the trademark, so what the hell? Yeah. So just so you know, Google, we're looking. We hear you. YouTube has decided to now support at username. Yay, YouTube handles. So this is, of course, the namespace used in Twitter and on Instagram and Facebook and everywhere. But in the past, we've had to say you go to youtube.com/twit. We will apply, and I hope we'll be able to call ourselves at Twit on YouTube. Right?
I think
you already have the...
We have it?
The URL.
For people,
I didn't do a URL.
I have a vanity URL already, and I would.
Yeah, that's different. No, it doesn't automatically.
Well, no, that should transfer over.
Should it?
But if you don't have a vanity URL, you have to apply for a handle, and you can't apply for a vanity URL anymore because they shut that down waiting for this to happen.
Oh, so there's going to be a gap of time where you can't do anything about it. Support for handles will start rolling out later next week to protect creators from having their channel name staked by someone else. YouTube notes that channels that already have a personalized URL.
Yep.
So normally you get x37941999. Once you get 1,000 followers, you can say, hey, I want to be /Aunt Pruitt or /Twit.
That's correct.
So you got that.
Yes, sir.
So you will then be at
@Aunt_Pruitt,
just like you are on Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, I'm already that. People tag me now on YouTube posts and comments just by doing that.
Oh, so it's already working for you.
It's already working for me. It's been that way for
After
a
handle is established, YouTube will additionally create a matching URL in the form of youtube.com/@handle, which would allow you to market your handle elsewhere on the web or in other media. And if the channel already had a personalized URL it was using for a similar purpose, you don't have to update your links. It all will continue to work. And at some point, everybody should be able to get a handle. Look for notifications to arrive in the next month. We already did the cloud gaming. I did some of the changelog stuff up front because I thought it was important.
Mm-hmm.
I like this new feature in Google Meet. It's always done recordings of your meeting. Now they'll send you transcriptions.
Zoom has had for quite some time, right?
Yeah, they've did quite a lot of stuff in Workspace. Users can already save Google Meet calls as video files. They'll soon get an automatic transcription of their meeting, too. It'll be a Google Doc. It'll start in English this week. Support for French, German, Spanish, and Portuguese is coming. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you'll have to push a button or something. Later this month, Google will roll out a Meet feature that will automatically center meeting participants in the frame of their video tile before they join a call. You can reframe yourself later, but it'll center you. That's nice. There's a meeting room.
I need to be centered. I just don't feel very centered these days.
I'm always centered.
There's a meeting room check. Well, actually, I have a problem with the centered stuff because Apple, and I bet you a lot of them, center you. So you know when we do stuff because we have lower thirds, we try to get your head like just a little skosh below the top of the frame. But Apple will put you down here in the center of the frame.
Oh, right.
Which bothers me.
Yeah.
It does look right to me.
It's all about TV that guy, middle third and when you do the lower third, not lower third, the rule of thirds grid.
Yeah.
And that
you shouldn't be in the middle.
Go across your eyes.
That puts you in the center square to block. You should be up.
I keep on wanting Kathy to get take that tape down off the wall behind her.
There's a piece. I know. I keep wanting to, but it's not my tape. So. Yeah.
We'll fix it in post.
When I went into this site with Soledad O'Brien, I was a virtual reality character, and they put a blue piece of tape on the wall for her to stare at because,
oh, right.
because she couldn't see me. Dev Null.
What's that called? Dev Null.
She couldn't see me, so she had the eye line had to be right, like she was looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
So
she should roll her eyes at the blue tape.
She did, believe me. Although I have to say, she was just on Andy Richter's Three Questions podcast, and she said very nice things about me, which I was very pleased.
Oh, yay. Yeah.
Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
That's so nice. That's so great.
She called me nice things. Here's the site open. Now, I just want to point out that here I am talking to her. She's staring at a blue piece of tape. Not me. Stop that, NBC. Stop that.
So he should get it repaired.
And I also want to point out, the reason I was thinking of this and I was watching this video is because I got a call or an email yesterday from the producer of the show, David Borman, who said, hey, you want the sign? Look at there. I want to see if I can see the sign as it starts the show here. There it is. This big sign, this big lit sign.
You can have it?
He said, do you want that? I have it at my house.
What is it? What is the sign?
It's the sign from the TV show that says the site. Let me see if I can find it. Here's another.
Okay.
Here's another. It's big. It's probably like 8 feet across. And he said, yeah, bring a pickup truck. It's heavy. He said, I don't think they want it at 30 Rock. I know they don't want it at 30 Rock. Probably nobody at 30 Rock even knows what the site was. I don't know if I can find another picture of it. But should I get it for the studio?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why not?
Oh, yeah.
Where would
Why not?
We could put it right there on the brick. Or, I don't know. Or maybe over here. I don't know. We could find somewhere for it. All right.
Radio corner.
Jeff, do you ever think, what's going to happen to all this junk when I die?
Yeah, I do. My wife can't wait to get rid of it all. And me, probably.
I think they're just going to pull up a big dumpster out front and just...
Oh, all these books? Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Jammer Beast, he's going to have a sale.
But you can't... Yeah, well, I mean, okay. So that's when I think, should I take this sign? I'm not that far from death's door. I mean...
So my wife is practically Marie Kondo. She keeps... But more than that... She puts everything into containers. Everything's in a container.
Yeah.
And so I know I'm going to get buried in Rubbermaid.
She could put you in a container.
Yeah.
I mean, in theory, that's called a coffin. But
no, it'll have a pop top on it. And yeah.
Oh, no.
You saw that the queen was buried in a lead-lined coffin.
Oh, yes.
That's and awesome. They said, yes, they do rather struggle lifting that coffin. It's very heavy. But there was an incident some many hundreds of years ago, and as a result, the monarch is always buried.
I don't know what the incident is.
What I liked is is it called the inscription, where they basically just said she died of old age?
Yeah.
I
is that what they said?
Yeah. I love that.
I want to die of old age. Really, oh, really
lead
old.
Prevents air and moisture from building up, aiding preservation.
Okay. I would think, well, Charles will be buried in a cardboard coffin. He wants a biodegradable. Oh, good news. California just made it legal to turn yourself into mulch.
Well, all right.
So
did you know that people's ashes are frequently spread in Central Park?
Yeah.
I found that out.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, that's not. Is that legal?
I suspect it is not legally.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it is.
They give.
It is.
On your own volition, or do you need a permit? Because I can't believe
it. I don't know if you need a permit, but I just saw a story.
Hey, buddy, you got a permit to spread those ashes over there?
No one's got permits.
New Pixel Buds Pro firmware update rolling out with 5-band EQ, bug fixes, and more.
Boy, on the brand new ones?
Deathly silence on that one. Yeah, on the new ones. Assistant driving mode ditches Google Maps integration. No longer an Android Auto replacement.
I'm so confused about this. I don't understand how this operates.
In May of 2019, Google Assistant driving mode was announced to replace Android Auto for phone screens. Remember Android Auto for phone screens? The launch occurred slowly.
Which was useless.
With the previous experience not going away until this June. So finally, a couple of months ago, they finally fully replaced Android Auto for phone screens with Google Assistant driving mode. Now, they're taking Google Maps integration away, which means it's useless. Actually, according to an update, 9to5 Google says Google is actually shutting down the Assistant driving mode dashboard. So, just add that to the
killed by Google.
There you go. That's
the beats keep coming.
The Google changelog. Boy, that's a big timpani. Let's take a little break. When we come back, we got picks of the week. Kathy, you may or may not. I know you're, you're short term short notice.
You're above this now.
You're above all this being in court. She's been barred. But you can pick something. You always pick something interesting.
I picked something. I think the URL is there, but my computer is struggling. So see if you see it.
Okay, save it because we don't want anybody to know.
No.
Picks of the week coming up in just a bit. But first, a word, just a personally from me to you, beseeching you, please begging you to join Club Twit. I know you probably have heard us talk about Club Twit. We started this earlier this year as we realized that, well, there are people who watch our shows who don't want to hear the ads. They don't want to be tracked. And that's kind of a necessity these days in podcast advertising. So we said, well, what we'll do is we'll give you ad-free versions of all the shows, no tracking, for $7 a month. Then we said, you know, we should throw in some other things. So we created this Club Twit Discord, which has turned out to be amazing. A lot of us are in there chatting about not just about the shows, but about everything going on in the world and coding and food and cooking and, you know, anime and beer and fitness and hardware. And Aunt Pruitt's our fabulous, wonderful community manager. He puts together events like Stacy's Book Club. We have shows that are exclusive to the club, for instance, like Hands on Macintosh with Micah Sargent and Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott. We've got the Untitled Linux Show with Jonathan Bennett, the Giz Fizz with Dick D. Bartolo, Stacy's Book Club. All of that goes on in the Discord and then goes out to the Twit Plus feed. That Twit Plus bonus content is all kinds of stuff. Those shows plus stuff that happens before and after our shows and just fun things. All of that for $7 a month. And it makes a big difference for us in keeping the lights on. You know, if you have a vision for what Twit might look like 5 years from now, I think Club Twit is vital to that future going forward. So I know a lot of you can't afford $7 a month. That's fine. We will always still offer this great free stuff. We don't want to put stuff, you know, we don't want to put our best stuff behind paywalls. But we have additional benefits that we understand. If you do pay $7, you know, it's a nice reason to do so. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit if you want to know more. You can buy any of those shows individually for $2.99 a month as well. And there's a yearly plan and there's corporate plans and all of that. So just a little plug for Club Twit because it really makes a big difference for us.
I had fun doing a stage recently.
Nice.
With one of our members, I was working on a test shot because, again, I'm trying to pitch the vineyards here for clients. And, you know, I just walked through my thought process on a stage with some of our members. And
it's
pretty fun. You know, and I want to do that more often.
It's a great group.
Hanging out with our members.
Really great group. We're very fond of our club, our little clubhouse, our little virtual clubhouse.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ant, for helming that and making it interesting. Twit.tv/clubtwit. Now, let me see, Kathy, if I got a link. Yes. Okay, go ahead. Kathy Gellis, her pick of the week.
Can you load it?
Yes. I have a picture of it. Hail to thee. So there was a play called Blythe Spirit many moons ago that was about a medium and a seance, right?
Yes. I don't quite remember so much about the plot of the play. The point for doing this is I'm very, very sad about the passing of Angela Lansbury. Yeah. I grew up watching Murder, She Wrote episodes. This was quite important to my growing up. But I include this link because I had the privilege of seeing her perform in Blythe Spirit. Not in the Broadway production, but there was a traveling production that came through San Francisco, and she was in it. And this is the review of the traveling production. And just such presence. I mean, it sort of skewed the production a little bit because she was a supporting character and the audience wanted to clap every time.
All they wanted was more Angela.
And it was a good production otherwise. And one of the people who played the man is a guy who played, who was on Downton Abbey.
Charles Edwards, Lady Edith's publisher. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, it was nice to see him act too, but, I recently also watched Death on the Nile, where she was also playing a supporting character, and she just steals the scene every time she's there. And this review was reminding me of the play that I saw where she was 89 years old and just owning that stage. And it was a very physical role, and she gave it everything. And it was just such a privilege to get to see her work, her craft. She was such a distinctive actress. And, you know, played like Jessica Fletcher is really admirable. Female character, absolutely tough, smart, but kind, and yes. So I will miss the woman who played her and also Jessica Fletcher because I always, miss Jessica.
She was a wonderful actor. It's amazing that she was able to do a 2-hour play 7 nights a week at the age of 89.
And then
to steal the show on top of it. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was really excellent, and it was a privilege to get to see her, and I can kind of see her in my mind a little bit.
I'm so jealous that you saw this. Simon Jones is also in it, who is a very well-known British actor who was in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Wow. I'm so jealous that you saw this, and I love it that she stole the show at the age of 89. I saw her in Sweeney Todd. That was an amazing production with I can't remember his name. He was so good. One of my favorite shows of all time.
Len Carew?
Yeah, Len Carew.
Yeah, he was also in Murder, She Wrote all the time. They were obviously friends.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
He
played a very interesting recurrent character. And my understanding is Murder, She Wrote tended to be cast with... She'd been in Hollywood for so long, so it basically was cast largely by her friends.
I don't think I've ever seen an episode. I'm going to have to start watching it. I saw her and Len Carew in one of the best shows of all time. And I knew nothing about it. I knew it was Sondheim. I love Sondheim. And it begins so dramatically and so wonderfully. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. So that's cool. Yeah, I'm a fan too. Sad to lose her. At 96, the same age as the Queen.
Yes, and my father.
And your father. Jeff Jarvis, do you have any other numbers?
I have the number is 911.
Uh-oh.
Because iPhones and their watches are calling 911 when people are on roller coasters thinking they've crashed. Now, mind you, if this happened with me and I was on a roller coaster, go ahead and send the ambulance. Because if I'm on a roller coaster with my fear of heights, I've had a heart attack.
I am dead. Yeah.
Yes.
Well... Wall Street Journal said that a small town emergency services had the Warren County Communications Center had received 6 crash detection calls from people at King's Island rides, all from iPhone 14s or new Apple Watches, triggered by the Joker roller coaster at 6. Oh, this is another one in Chicago at Six Flags Great America Chicago.
The problem
is that this thing's in your pocket, and
so you don't know, and it's like you're screaming,
and
it's loud.
You're screaming, So 911 doesn't usually like that, but they've got to follow it down.
The Wall Street Journal version has the audio of the call. It's not that exciting, but it's
because it says there was a severe crash. Not there might be a severe crash, but there was a severe crash. So there's not, Anyway, I think it's on balance a good thing.
Here's the call.
This is the phone calling 911.
In fact, I was taking three rings. It's upsetting.
Where are they?
The owner of this iPhone was in a severe car crash.
So it's the voice just saying the owner of this iPhone was in a severe crash. And you hear the screams in the background. You hear screams.
Wow. So this is a fixable problem. Apple just has to add, if you hear screams and roller coaster sounds, or, you know, just say, hey, are they at Six Flags? Maybe you shouldn't.
I was going to say, is that written in the code?
Again.
If hear scream, then...
Yeah. You know,
if it's a scream and it's a Six Flag and it's me, I'm having a heart attack. Come, please, come.
I love it. 911. And now, Ant, your thing of the week.
My thing of the week is the folks at Aperture. They have their Amaran edition of lights, and this is their more budget-friendly version of lights. Aperture makes a bunch of studio lights and LED lights that are quite expensive, but they're really daggum good. And the Amaran brand is basically competing with the likes of Godox. They're a little more expensive than Godox, but not by much. And they're nice, pretty nice build quality. They're not as metallic, so there's still some plastic casing and stuff on them. The reflector is nice. I have the 100D here. The D stands for daylight color temperature. They have a couple that are bicolor, so you can change the color temperature on them. And pretty good pricing on them, and the fans are quiet. It's not super loud when you turn them up to high power. The reflector is definitely different. Seems like it gives you a bit of a narrow beam when you put the reflector on it, so just be mindful of that. But, yeah, pretty good price. I think this 100D is like $200.
And, oh, look, you could mount a...
And you can put an umbrella on. Umbrella. Not all of the lights in that range allow you to mount umbrellas to them like that.
That's nice. In case it's raining, right?
Right. In cases of rain. That's exactly why
that's
you
what
want
that's
it.
For. Yeah. Aputure. Aperture.
And then next, I was on the mobile filmmaking podcast, SBP mobile filmmaking podcast, with Miss Susie Botello, who actually listens to and watches Twig every week.
Hi, Susie.
So thank you, Miss Susie.
Hi, Susie.
Thanks for having me on and having a candid conversation about smartphone photography in particular, and talked a little bit about iPhone 14 and all of its capabilities. Mr. Scott Bourne has been on there. You know Mr. Scott Bourne.
Oh, yeah.
He's been on there before. It was good chat, so check that out. And lastly, of course, I have to always talk about family. Queen Pruitt's ticks are available. They've started the promotions and so forth because their last show has just finished. So I know a lot of you Twig and Twit folks are here in the area because I've bumped into you a couple times. So if you're in the area, go order a ticket and check out the show.
November 18th through December 4th at the Studio Theater, Santa Rosa Junior College. SpongeBob the musical. Would you say it's suitable for children?
Yes. I've watched it, unfortunately. Yes, it's suitable for children.
Many, many times.
It's at the Burbank Theater. It's a pretty nice theater, too.
And Queen Pruitt plays?
Sandy Cheeks. Yeah.
Okay. I have a question for you. My son, the TikTok star, wants to get a Canon Cinema. And he's trying to decide between the R5C and the C70. Do you have an opinion?
Yes. For me, I would go the R5C because you get both sides
of the
spectrum. You get the the photography side.
He doesn't care because he doesn't do stills. It's just for video.
Okay. So if you go, but the thing is,
he does have an R5. I bought him an R5 some time ago, about a year ago. But he wants the cinema because it's all about the video for him, right?
Well, both of them are really good for video. The only main difference I would point out with the C70 is the C70 has a Super 35 sensor, so it's going to be a tight crop factor.
It's not full frame.
It's not full frame, but you're still getting good dynamic range and getting the dual gain ISO on there. So, ISO. So it's going to be pretty good for both of them. But just depends on what you want. So I would have said the R5C because you're getting the best of both worlds.
I will tell him. I said I'd ask you.
Tell him. I need to get him for a chat. So I need to get in touch with him.
Yeah. Well, he's going to have some stuff to promote soon.
Okay.
That's all I can say.
Good for him.
Yeah. Very exciting. He's doing really well. Kathy Gellis, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine R. Yay. Gellis, Esquire. She is at Kathy with a C Gellis on the Twitter and CG Council, council.com. She, of course, focuses, as you could probably tell, on legal issues relating to the digital age and amicus briefs to her friends at the High Court. Thank you so much. It was great to get you on.
She's also calling out Expedia. Was it Expedia.com that you had to call out and get them to fix their crap?
Oh, they didn't. Sort of backfill it, but no, that was no joy with Expedia. And then my friend had a similar problem. I don't know what's happened to that service. It is not what it used to be. So, yep, not happy.
I did. I got suckered by them. They did a search result and sent me to a pretty shady booking site for international travel. So I was very disappointed.
So, oh no!
You gotta be careful. I think nowadays these people. I swear, Mr. Jeff Jarvis, you know who he is, the director of the Town Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. Follow him at buzzmachine.com. And he's Jeff Jarvis.
And order my book at bit.ly/buygutenberg.
The Gutenberg book. When is it coming out?
June. So you got plenty of time.
Don't rush. No, you should rush.
Pre-orders get it.
He doesn't even know what font it's going to be in yet.
No.
We'll talk about that next week. With Kevin Marks and Glenn Fleischman, the Gutenberg parenthesis from Bloomsbury. That's a spectacular deal, too. Thank you, Aunt Pruitt. Hands-on photography. What you got coming up?
This week, we're going to talk about color. We're going to talk about color in your photos and color in your videos. And I'm not talking about saturation and vibrance. It's just more the mood and how to really use color to tell the story
that
you're presenting.
It's going to be fun. So much from the show. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aunt. Thanks to all of you. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday right after Windows Weekly. That's about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. You can watch us do it live at live.twit.tv. Chat with us while you're watching at irc.twit.tv. Of course, Club Twit members can also chat in our Discord. After the fact, get copies of the show ad-supported but free at twit.tv/twig. There is a This Week in Google YouTube channel where you can go to watch the video. That's a good place to go if you want to share a little clip or whatever. That YouTube makes that pretty easy. I guess we're going to have to see if we can get at Twig. Because I don't...
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's This Week in Google. So we'd be at This Week in Google. I wonder how we get at Twig.
What is going on with my keyboard?
I have to figure that out. Anyway, you can also subscribe in your favorite podcast client. Just search for Twig or This Week in Google or Twit. Probably search for Twit. That's the easiest thing to do. You can see all the shows. And if your podcast client allows for reviews, please do us a favor and leave a 5-star review. Thank you, everybody. Again, next week, Kevin Marks and Glenn Fleischman. The week following, Rabble joins us, which should be very interesting to talk about his new Twitter clone from a guy who worked at Twitter. He'll also have some inside information, I think, on Project Blue Sky. And the following week, Stacy will be back with a giant cast on her little toe. Oh, is it a big toe or little toe?
No, pinky toe.
Pinky toe.
Sorry.
The little piggy that went wee, wee, wee all the way home. Just a little too vigorously. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time on Twig. Bye-bye.
I'm Jason Howell. How do you thank your hardworking team? Well, with a Club Twit corporate subscription, of course. You can show your appreciation and reward your tech team with a subscription to Club Twit, and that way, they'll be informed and entertained with podcasts covering the latest in technology. With a Club Twit subscription, they're going to get access to all of our podcasts ad-free, the members-only Discord, exclusive outtakes, behind-the-scenes and special content, and exclusive shows like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit and look for corporate plans for complete details.